This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Everyone, this is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. We have an action-packed show for you this morning. I am grateful that you have made the decision to listen to it, or if you're just stumbling upon our radio station, hopefully we can give you something to listen to for the next 4 hours. I want to begin by asking the question, how bad is it out there? Historian and documentary filmmaker Ken Burns, who, irrespective of what you think of him, is an incredibly talented documentarian and filmmaker. His baseball documentary for PBS, magical. One of the best things I've ever seen. The Civil War documentary, phenomenal. His miniseries on the Roosevelts had one or two things that I took issue with editorially, but by and large, incredibly well-made, incredibly informative. The guy is a gifted filmmaker. If a subject gets the Ken Burns treatment, you know when you watch it, whether it's about Vietnam, Muhammad Ali, baseball, the Civil War, or the Roosevelts, you know when you watch it, you are going to learn something. And that's what a documentary really should be. There's nothing worse than watching a documentary and it's a subject that you followed closely and you don't learn anything. What's the point? It's a waste of an hour and a half. The best documentaries, from what I can tell, are engaging and they're interesting to people that know about a subject and that don't know about a subject. And both of them are able to watch it and learn something from it. And I find that that's certainly the case with Ken Burns' documentaries. So I was very interested in some comments that Ken Burns made this week. Ken Burns was on a podcast. It's called Smart Less. It's a podcast co-hosted by Will Arnett and Jason Bateman. They were both on Arrested Development, and a gentleman named Sean Hayes. And he actually went so far as to say, when questioned by Will Arnett, that the current era of American policy is pretty bad. How bad is it? Listen to what Ken Burns had to say, and then tell me if you agree.
You've been making films about the American experience and about America for the, you know, whatever, it's been over 40 years. Do you have a cynical view now of where we're headed and where we've come from? Is it doom and gloom, or are you, do you feel okay?
Well, I don't think anybody has the luxury at this moment of being cynical. Cynical's a, just debauchery is just a luxury of too much time and too many things that you're not doing with your hands that you begin doing with your hands. It's really serious. There are three great crises before this: the Civil War, the Depression, and World War II. This is equal to it.
So if you listen to what Ken Burns said there, that's pretty serious. What he's saying is the current era in which America is living in is equal to the three great crises that, this is how he characterized it, that the country has faced: World War II, the Great Depression, and the Civil War. I'm just curious, do you agree? Why or why not? 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. Curious as to your take on this. I'll tell you where I recognize the country has a lot of problems right now. You still have the COVID pandemic, which we're going to get into with Dr. Joel Zinberg coming up in about 20 minutes. He has some reasons for optimism on that front, actually. You have all this misinformation online. You have all this political division in the country today. Democrats and Republicans not even wanting to sit and talk with one another. People viewing, I listen to some of the callers, not just on this show, but on some of the other shows. when they describe the opposition political party, it doesn't sound like they're folks that they don't want to vote for. It sounds like they're folks that they hate. And you have climate change and all sorts of other issues right now. I don't think, I'm of two minds, but by and large, I don't think things are as bad as World War II, the Great Depression, and the Civil War. I don't. I think by and large, if you look at the individual freedoms that people experience today, including historically persecuted groups like minorities and gays, I think things are pretty good. If you look at the standard of living for the average American, I think even the poorest among us has a television set. That's not something that you could say 20, 30, 40 years ago. I think the technological innovations that the country has enjoyed have really helped to lift the standard of living. And again, we have our problems. I am not trying to sugarcoat it. But to say it's as bad as World War II, the Depression, and the Civil War, I don't agree. And I don't pretend to have Ken Burns' level of historical knowledge. But come on. Civil War, the bloodiest, deadliest war in American history, is that where we are now? I don't think so. That being said, there is there's a pair of generational theorists named Strauss and Howe, and my friend Rich Hoffman turned me on to these guys, and they make a lot of sense. And they wrote one book called The History of America's Future. One of them is no longer with us. The other one is still very vocal. And they write about how all of American history is essentially cycles, and how every 80 years there's a major crisis that defines not only that generation, but the generation that comes after it and the generation that comes after it. And if you think about it, what are the three most noteworthy events in American history? If you name only three historical events in American history, what would they be? Well, I think most of us would pick the same three events. The American Revolution, the Civil War, and World War II / the Great Depression, which happened around the same time. The interesting thing about all those events is that they all occurred around 80 years after one another. Not exactly, but roughly 80 years after one another. Crisis. And if you look at what's happened 80 years after World War II, where are we? Well, that's just about right now. So we're about due for one of these, if you buy into Strauss and Howe. We're about due for one of these major once-in-a-generation crises. Tell me, do you buy it? Why or why not? George is in Pearl River. Hello, George.
What's going on, Frank?
You tell me, George.
You know what, Frank? I don't think anybody even cares. You know what? Look, bottom line, I don't know everything we're talking about. This government's letting everybody in. Nobody cares about history. You know what? Pretty soon there's gonna be no American flag. Nobody cares about anything like that. You know what I'm saying?
So it sounds like you agree with Ken Burns. Things are as bad as World War II, the Great Depression.
There's nothing gonna change. Everything. Let me tell you something. Not to be racist, I'm white. The white man's being eliminated. I don't care what anybody is like or not. Everything's eliminated and level the playing field. And you know what? If nobody agrees with it, that's just too bad. There's not even going to be an American flag within, I don't know, whatever timetable you want. That's my point. I swearly believe nobody cares about history, nothing.
All right, so I'm going to count that as a yes vote, that things are as bad as the Depression, World War II, and the Civil War. 800-848-9222. Ken Burns, historian, documentary filmmaker, says things are as bad as they have been in the three major crises this country's faced. He characterizes them as the Civil War, World War II, and the Great Depression. My question for you, wherever you fall historically, politically, age-wise, gender-wise, ethnicity-wise, do you agree? Do you agree that things are as bad now as they were during the Civil War, World War II, and the Great Depression? Why or why not? 800-848-9222. Rick is in Freeport. Hello, Rick.
Good evening. Good evening. I lived through two of those. I was 93 today.
Oh, happy birthday, Rick.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Good morning. Well, I tell you, in World War II, we knew our enemy. There was no question about it. Today, we don't know our enemy. Our enemies change. The Depression was terrible. But at least in the Depression, I think we had our religion. We had churches. Today, very few people go to church.
So, again, the answer to my question, Rick, is do you agree with Ken Burns or do you not agree?
Yes and no.
Interesting.
Yes and no. World War II, we were better. We're better off today. I mean, and also during the Depression. Well, maybe two yeses. With the Depression, at least today, you have all sorts of social services, which we did not have during the Depression. I was born in 1928. It was just the beginning of the Depression, and World War II brought us out of it. Now, I don't know what's going to bring us out of what we're in today.
All right, Rick. What do you see as the great major problem that the world is facing right now, or at least that America is facing right now?
Well, I tell you what I think it is. I think it's education. I think it's our teaching. I think it's our schools. Our schools do not teach democracy.
Well,
when we went to.
Yeah, Rick.
Yes.
Yeah, no, Rick, you know, I have been banging the drum for civic education for a long time, and I think you're right about that. And I think that's whatever the problem is, whatever you view the problem as these days, I think the lack of civic education, to your point, is a big part of the cause of that problem. Thank you. Ken Burns goes on the Smart Less podcast with Will Arnett and says this.
You've been making films about the American experience and about America for the, you know, whatever, it's been over 40 years. Do you have a cynical view now of where we're headed and where we've come from? Is it doom and gloom, or do you feel okay?
Well, I don't think anybody has the luxury at this moment of being cynical. Cynical's a, like just debauchery is just a luxury of too much time and too many things that you're not doing with your hands that you begin doing with your hands.
Yeah.
It's really serious. There are three great crises before this, the Civil War, the Depression, and World War II. This is equal to it.
Equal to the Civil War, the Great Depression, and World War II. Do you agree? Or disagree? 800-848-9222. LQ is in the Bronx. Hello.
Good morning, and God bless you, Mr. Morano.
Thank you.
Hello?
Yeah, you too.
My answer is similar to, and happy birthday to 93rd birthday to Mr. Rick.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
It's similar to his. It's yes and no. To me, it's getting, it could be almost, if we don't have, a spiritual revival in this country, it could be a civil war. So it's partially, and the other one, the immigration thing, is very similar to, if not worse than the immigration that came, it's worse, you know, so in some ways that, but the Great Depression, no. So this, both ways to your answer, my answer to your question.
All right. Well, thank you, LQ. And it's interesting, on that podcast, Ken Burns went on to quote a portion of a speech made by Abraham Lincoln in 1838 in Springfield, Illinois. In the speech, which is titled "The Perpetuation of Our Political Institutions," Lincoln warned that those who disrespected U.S. laws and courts could destroy the nation at large. This is the quote that Burns read from. From whence shall we expect the approach of danger? Shall some transatlantic military giant step the earth and crush us at a blow? Never. All the armies of Europe, Asia, and Africa could not by force take a drink from the Ohio River or make a track on the Blue Ridge in the trial of a thousand years. No. If destruction be our lot, we must ourselves be its author and finisher. As a nation of free men, we will live forever or die by suicide. That was what Lincoln said. Ken Burns read from that, and then he adds, and we're looking right down the muzzle of that gun. Do you agree or disagree? I'd love to have somebody a little optimistic, right? A little somebody saying, things are great now. Ken Burns is on drugs. He doesn't know what he's talking about. But nobody's saying that. Everybody seems to be as dour as Ken Burns is. 800-848-WABC. Evelyn is in Valley Stream. Hello, Evelyn.
Yes. I want to say,
Evelyn, would you turn your radio off, please?
Okay. Okay.
All right, we're gonna come back to you. Turn your radio off and we'll come back. And everybody that's on hold, please make sure your radio's off. Larry's in Brooklyn. Hello, Larry.
Yeah, hi, Frank. Great question. You know, I believe that I don't believe in cycles, okay, but I believe that certain things do repeat themselves, and I believe that we are in a worse situation than what propelled the Civil War, because the Civil War was about a known collective wrong, slavery. It was known, but they resented the imposition of it on them, the South. However, now we're in a position where this is not a known collective wrong. I'm getting myself confused. Slavery was a consensus. Even the South knew it was wrong, but they didn't like the fact that it was being imposed upon them. Here we're bussing people in. Everybody knows it's wrong, and they're imposing people. Bussing foreigners in, it's an invasion. So this is the people that are doing it know it's wrong. It's a situation that's even more compelling than the Civil War. And in the sense that if we don't revolt, if there is not a civil war, this country could be very well lost. Okay, and I think there should be a civil war, frankly.
So, needless to say, you agree with Ken Burns about the severity of the current crisis.
As pertains to the Civil War, I think the analogy has to stop there, because the Civil War is a constitutional crisis within this country. The World War II and the Depression are not comparable, and one's economic and one is international.
Well, I mean, the comparison, Larry, is, at least in Ken Burns' mind, is that those were the three greatest crises the country has ever faced. And he's saying that the time we're in now is as great as those three great crises. 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. Bob is in New Jersey. Hello, Bob.
Hi, how you doing? Thanks for answering.
Sure. Thanks, Bob. Well, what's on your mind?
Kudos to the 93-year-old. Happy birthday to him. God bless. And I think he's wrong. I think that things are not that bad as they seem. I'm in my 60s, and since I was a kid, as long as I can remember, they said they're doing away with drugs. They're going to fight drugs. The drugs are still on the street. Nothing's ever changed. The corruption is still in politics. Everything is still the same. It's really not that bad, as he's saying, you know, and everything is completely blown out of proportion, I think, by the news media to sell commercials. You know what I mean?
Well, look, Bob, this is
as bad as it is World War II or the Depression.
That is exactly what I was hoping somebody would say. Now, I don't know if you're right or if you're wrong, or I don't know if Ken Burns is right or you're wrong. But I love that sense of optimism, and I love looking for a silver lining. And I'll be honest, again, I didn't live through the Depression, as I'm sure many of you did, but I don't think that it's as bad now as it was during the Depression. If you look at the overall quality of living that Americans have today, I think it's far better than during the Civil War or World War II. That being said, we've got a lot of problems right now. We've got a lot of problems. So my question for you is Ken Burns right when he says this is as dangerous and as bad a time as the three greatest crises we've seen in our country? 800-848-9222. Ed is calling from Massachusetts. What do you think, Ed?
You know, I would, when he says as bad as, I think that's a little confusing because the Depression, things were materially bad. And in World War II, things were dangerous. I think the better way to describe it to me, it's like 1776 or 1861. Those would be the two things I would compare. In that we're at a point where there's no way to split the difference. There's no way to compromise. I mean, Lincoln also made a speech where he said, and this was in the Ken Burns Civil War series, he said, the country's either going to go ahead all slave or all free, but it can't go ahead half and half anymore. One or the other side is going to have to dominate completely. And I think that's the right way to think about it.
All right. Well, it makes sense to me, Ed, and Lincoln did say that. That's fair. 800-848-WABC. Frank is in Babylon. Hello, Frank.
Hey, hi, Frank. This is Frank.
Hey, Frank.
I wanted to weigh. Yeah, right?
Amazing.
Wanted to weigh in, and I'm optimistic, as you are. I don't agree with the gentleman's point of view that this is as bad as worse than those times that he spoke about. And the reason why I say that is because, hands down, I think there's no better time to be alive in history. I think that we're on the verge of a huge amount of opportunity that we've probably never experienced before this. There's lots and lots of problems, there's no doubt. I believe they will be solved. I have to be optimistic. I'm sorry. I don't take the pessimistic.
Frank, I'll be honest. I kind of come down where you are, and I recognize that all the problems we're facing are very serious, and I'm not trying to sugarcoat them, and I'm not trying to act like they're not. We're not on the verge of something very, very problematic here, and we're already experiencing problematic things. We just lost more people in a pandemic than we did during the Spanish flu. But I am with you. I think that there is still a lot of reasons to be grateful to be alive in America today. And I appreciate you recognizing that, Frank. All right. Those of you that are holding, we will get to you in a bit. But we're going to talk with Dr. Joel Zinberg next. Dr. Joel Zinberg is both a lawyer and a doctor. He's with the Competitive Enterprise Institute. And he wrote this really interesting op-ed in the New York Post about how close, talk about things to be grateful for, how close we are right now to achieving herd immunity. We're going to explore it next. A very different message from what we're hearing from Dr. Fauci and others. But speaking of COVID, a lot of people right now still wearing masks all over the place. And a lot of people required to wear masks all over the place. Waiters, bartenders, construction workers, warehouse workers, travelers. If this applies to you, why wouldn't you at least want your mask to be comfortable and effective? That's where EasyFlow USA comes in. EasyFlow is a personal air filtration system. For more details, you can go to EasyFlowUSA.com. That's EasyFlowUSA.com. And it pushes fresh, filtered air directly into your mask, allowing you to breathe normally and more comfortably. It's recommended by medical professionals everywhere, and it's tested in an FDA-approved lab to filter out 99.7% of virus and bacteria, including COVID. Makes your mask more effective, drier, and more comfortable. Get yours today at EasyFlowUSA.com. That's EasyFlowUSA.com. And if you enter the promo code radio in your order, you'll save 20% off your purchase.
77 WABC, All-American.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
I told the witch doctor I was in love with you. I told the witch doctor I was in love with you. And then the witch doctor, he told me what to do. He said that...
This is The Other Side of Midnight on 77 WABC. I'm Frank Morano. Obviously, if you have a discussion about anything over the course of the last year and a half or so, it involves a discussion of COVID. And the one thing everyone seems to be asking is, when is this over? Well, it was a fascinating op-ed in the New York Post recently, which says that the end of all this could be sooner than we realize, or at least sooner than a lot of the experts are telling us, written by a man who's a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute and an associate clinical professor of surgery at the Icahn Mount Sinai School of Medicine here in New York. Also, probably has his mother in the Jewish Parents Hall of Fame because he's both a doctor and a lawyer. Gives me a great deal of pleasure to welcome Dr. Joel Zinberg. Dr. Zinberg, thanks for joining me on the radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure to do so.
Dr. Zinberg, so your column was fascinating. I quoted from it at length the day that it was written. But for people that haven't read it, and I've linked to it on my Facebook page, I hope people check it out, facebook.com/MoranoFan. You write that the U.S. is nearing immunity from COVID-19. How close do you think we are?
Well, look, it's hard to say, you know, how many weeks, but barring a new variant, which is either extremely contagious or escapes the immunity that's out there, I think we're probably, you know, close to, in the next few weeks, being at the point where you are no longer having large numbers of cases and certainly not having large numbers of serious cases, hospitalizations, and deaths. I think what people have to realize is this is a virus that's probably become what's called endemic. It's going to be circulating in one form or another, perhaps for a very long time. But the important thing is how many people become ill with it. And I think we are reaching a point where we're probably going to reach a very low state of people getting ill from COVID.
One of the things I really enjoyed about your column is that when you're calculating the likelihood of herd immunity, you include not just the people that are vaccinated, but the people who've acquired natural immunity from getting the disease and recovering from it. Just for the sake of clarity, because I feel like we've heard some conflicting things from this on from different authorities. Is natural immunity, as far as you can tell, as good as immunity that's acquired through vaccination?
Right. So natural immunity, which results from having the infection and recovering, is something that with most viruses is as good or better than vaccine immunity. And that appears to be the case with COVID. There's a study out of Israel that suggests that not only is the natural immunity as good, that it's actually far better than the vaccine immunity. And that's confirmed with some studies from other places like the Cleveland Clinic, which looked at more than 52,000 healthcare workers and found that the natural immunity was just as good as the vaccine immunity, and it lasted for quite a while. And there are other studies indicating that the natural immunity could last for at least 12 months, which is at this point longer than what we know the vaccine immunity lasts for.
What do we think the magic number is in terms of herd immunity? If you're adding the vaccinated plus those that have acquired natural immunity, is it 80%? Is it 90%? Is it 95%? What do we think the magic number is?
Again, this is, you know, somewhat a matter of speculation because no one knows exactly which variant's going to be circulating at any particular point. But originally, people were talking about numbers like 75-80%, something like that. Now, when you had a variant like Delta, which was more contagious, the number goes up. But it's not, you know, it's still not as nearly as contagious as something like measles, where you need, you know, about 90-95% immunity for herd immunity. It's probably somewhere in the 80s. And, you know, we have at this point roughly about 80% of the population, maybe a little more, has either vaccine or natural immunity. And in addition, you have another 20 million people who've gotten at least one dose of the vaccine, which granted isn't as good as the full two-dose regimen, but it does give you some degree of protection. So we're pretty close, I think, to probably where herd immunity will come in.
Why do we hear what you're saying so infrequently in the press and from experts? I can't imagine that public health authorities want people to perpetually live in fear, but it seems like that's kind of the logical byproduct of not acknowledging what you've just mentioned.
Well, look, from the public health perspective, we would like people to continue to get vaccinated. So I think there probably are some folks in that community who, with all good intentions, are trying to encourage people to get vaccinated, which is a very good thing, and I would encourage all your listeners to do. And perhaps that's the sort of most benevolent approach. Then there are others who I think, just to be honest with you, would like to have the crisis continue for a bit longer if possible.
Talking with Dr. Joel Zinberg. He is an attorney and a medical doctor, a senior fellow at the Competitive Enterprise Institute, and an associate clinical professor of surgery at the Icahn Mount Sinai School of Medicine here in New York. You mentioned that Israeli study, which seems to show that natural immunity is just as good, if not better, as immunity that's acquired through vaccination. I mentioned that a couple of times, in part because of your column, and I was deluged with a bunch of people saying, well, but that study is just one study and it's not yet peer-reviewed. How credible do you find that Israeli study to be?
Look, the Israelis are probably the best in the world, number one, at getting the people vaccinated, but number two, at collecting data on this. And the Israelis are using primarily the Pfizer vaccine, but that was one way that they got early access to the Pfizer vaccine, that they agreed they would collect all this data and give it back to Pfizer so that Pfizer would know how to move forward with the vaccine in other countries. So, you know, I think the Israeli data is suggesting it was done during a period of time when Delta was dominant in Israel, which is unlike most of the other studies that are comparing natural and vaccine immunity, which were done earlier. And it showed that the risk of infection was 13 times higher for vaccinated people than for people with natural immunity. And that was when the people were had been either infected or vaccinated in the same time period, which was, you know, roughly about 4 to 7 months ago. What they had the luxury of also doing was looking at people who had been infected back at the beginning of the pandemic, so 10, 11, 12 months ago, and those people still had better protection than people who were vaccinated more recently. So I think it's, you know, it's a very interesting study, highly suggestive of natural immunity being good. And it's confirmed by some other studies. As I mentioned earlier, a study of 52,000 healthcare workers at the Cleveland Clinic found no difference. And, you know, you have multiple studies, both the Cleveland Clinic and some others, indicating long-term protection from natural immunity. So I think it's likely true.
So this is a question that I get asked a great deal, and that is, given what you just said, right, given that the Israeli study and the Cleveland Clinic study seem to suggest that if you've had the virus and you've recovered from it, you're in pretty good shape not to get it again. Should people, would your advice as a doctor and as a public health authority yourself, would your advice to people who've already had the virus be to get the vaccine, even if they've had the virus and recovered from it? That seems to be what Dr. Fauci is suggesting. Or would it be to skip the vaccine?
Well, look, there are two aspects of this. It seems like if you've been infected and recovered and then get the vaccine on top of that, you get a better immune response. But that doesn't change the fact that people who have natural immunity have already have a very good immune response, and it's as good as vaccine. So it almost becomes a question of like getting a booster after you've had the full two shots. You know, grant you've gotten very good protection from the two shots vaccines. Do you want to get even better protection by adding a third shot, a booster? And it's really very much the same issue. And so from the individual level, if you don't have contraindications to getting a shot, an extra shot, it's probably a good idea. And particularly if you're in a group that's very vulnerable to having severe COVID disease, like the elderly or people with lots of medical conditions who have seen to be the disproportionately among the people who get in the hospital or who end up dying from this disease. But on the other hand, if there's a particular reason that you cannot get a vaccine or a strongly held belief that you don't want to get the vaccine, you probably have pretty good protection already from either the two doses of the vaccine or from natural immunity. So, you know, it's a question of on the individual level, I would suggest people get it. Do I think mandating that extra dose is appropriate? No, I don't think it's appropriate because I think both from vaccines and from natural immunity, you already have pretty good protection, which for the moment appears to be lasting. That may change, but at the moment it appears to be good.
What are the public policy implications for what you're saying here, namely that we're getting close to some degree of herd immunity? We have in New York City vaccine mandates for restaurants in schools in New York and New Jersey. We have mask mandates for students, students as young as two. Given where we are with respect to this virus, what should the public policy ramifications of that be?
Well, look, states and local governments have long-standing authority to take various public health measures, including vaccines. And that goes all the way back to a 1905 Supreme Court case called Jacobson v. Massachusetts. It's not unlimited authority, but you know, by and large, that authority will usually be upheld because it falls under what, you know, our system and our Constitution reserve to the states. And that's what's called the police powers to protect public health and safety. So from and also businesses have the authority as long as they comply with various anti-discrimination statutes and the Americans with Disabilities Act. They have the authority to require vaccination or proof of vaccination, both for workers and for their customers. The public policy issue that I think is more pressing in light of recent events, though, is what's the federal government doing here? And the federal government has been pushing various initiatives like an eviction moratorium or most recently the proposal by the president that OSHA issue what are called emergency temporary standards to require workplace vaccination. The question is, does the federal government have authority to do that? And in the case of the eviction moratorium, the Supreme Court has already indicated no, not under the laws we have existing. And I think it's highly likely, should the OSHA actually issue those standards, that courts will strike those down as well. So this is not a, this from the public health perspective, this is an area where state and local governments can embark on it, and they're held accountable by their constituents. But this is not an area where the federal government has the authority to do it, and nor do I think, in light of the theme of the article, that we're closing in on you know, widespread immunity, that it's necessarily advisable.
In terms of the eviction moratorium, it's interesting. It seems like the COVID pandemic has been the thing that anybody can use as the excuse for anything. If you don't want to go to a wedding that's too far, you could use the COVID epidemic as the excuse not to go. If you want to institute some public policy or another, whether it's an eviction moratorium or an infrastructure bill, you can use the COVID pandemic as an excuse for that. You mentioned the Supreme Court ruling on the eviction moratoriums. Let me ask you about a court battle that's playing out here in New York. Maybe take advantage of not only your medical perspective, but your legal expertise. We see this lawsuit working its way through the courts of these healthcare workers who've sued because they don't want to get vaccinated and they're subject to a vaccine mandate. They won the first round, as I understand it. How do you see that playing out in the courts?
Well, look, I think, as I mentioned before, there's pretty well established authority for organizations, for first of all, state government to require vaccines, and also for individual organizations, and particularly in the realm of healthcare organizations, where you know physicians, nurses, and other people working in hospitals are taking care of vulnerable patients. You know, there's pretty good authority that they can require these things. So I think ultimately, you know, I'm not familiar with the you know intricacies of this case, but I think ultimately the requirement is going to be upheld. And by the way, this is a requirement that many hospitals have for influenza, for the flu vaccine, that they require their staff to be vaccinated. So ultimately, I think that those things will be upheld.
Now, in terms of the vaccine skeptics in our audience, I know you're pro-vaccine as I am. I've been vaccinated and encourage people to get vaccinated. There are still people that don't trust it. There are still people that think this was approved too quickly, that we haven't had sufficient opportunity to examine the longitudinal studies or effects of this. What do you say to those folks who may be reluctant to get vaccinated for any reason? And I've heard several, some because they are looking to get pregnant and they're worried about infertility, some for a variety of other reasons. What do you say to the vaccine skeptics in our audience?
I say that these vaccines are some of the most intensively studied medicines that we've had in decades. You know, think about it. In our country alone, over 200 million people have received vaccines, and they're being followed very closely both by the companies and by the FDA. And by all indications, side effects, thankfully, are pretty rare, and they're usually not long-lasting. So, you know, this is much there have been many, many millions more people who've received these vaccines than typically receive other kinds of medicines, but you don't see people objecting to those. Now, I know people with vaccines think, oh, well, why should I get a shot that's just to prevent something when I'm, you know, I'm healthy, and why should I risk myself to prevent something, whereas when they normally take a medicine to treat a particular illness? I think those folks ought to realize that the risks of bad things happening to them are much, much higher if they get COVID and get sick from it. In other words, no one has died from the vaccine, and the side effects are rare, but they're the getting severe disease from COVID is much more common than getting a side effect from the vaccine. So that's what they have to think about. And if, and particularly for people in the audience who fall into these vulnerable groups, people, say, 60 and older, or people who have other medical conditions like hypertension or obesity, diabetes, they ought to be thinking that they are risking their lives by not getting the vaccine.
Is there a danger in people embracing what you're saying in terms of you're saying that we're pretty close to immunity because of all the vaccinated folks and of all the people that have had the virus? Is there a danger that people may decide to act more reckless, to go to a party with unmasked hordes of 300 people hugging, kissing and breathing on everybody that could exacerbate the spread of this virus?
Look, there's always a possibility of spread, but if you are vaccinated, you are pretty well protected, and we're now at a point where most of the people you're going to encounter are vaccinated as well. So you have to realize, to become infected with COVID, you've got to encounter someone who is infected and is shedding the virus, and you've got to spend a certain, you know, like 15, 20 minutes with them in a relatively close contact. So that becomes very unlikely when you're in a situation where you have more than 80% of the population has some sort of immunity and is extremely unlikely to be infected themselves.
Dr. Joel Zinberg from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, I very much appreciate the time this morning. Hope we can chat again soon.
My pleasure. Thanks.
If you want to comment on any portion of our discussion, you're welcome to give me a call, 1-800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
Dr. My eyes.
Jackson Brown, Dr. My Eyes. Very apropos after my conversation with Dr. Joel Zinberg. I'm going to get to your calls in just a moment. It's funny. We got an email yesterday from the assistant program director. Went to the whole floor. And subject was newsroom cleanliness. And the email itself said, the newsroom is not a cafeteria. If you're eating, please eat in the kitchen or a cubicle. We need to keep the newsroom clean and the equipment functional. Please acknowledge you receive and understand this directive. And I was glad that that email went out, because I haven't noticed much of a problem here. But at other radio stations that I've worked at, that has become a problem. And someone else, our vice president of engineering, follows up on that email, sends it to everybody that works here, and says, thank you for this. We've had some recent incidents with coffee spilling in studios, too. No damage was caused, but we were an inch away from losing some gear. Now, I'm glad that he mentioned this, and I'm hopeful that people are going to be aware of this. And I have a cup of coffee in the studio now. I'm going to be super careful after seeing this and hearing about that. But it did remind me of a story. This is going back almost 20 years. In about 20 years. Steve Malzberg, who used to work here, and this is when we were in our old studio at 2 Penn Plaza above Madison Square Garden. He brought in one day a cup of chicken soup, right? And he is eating the chicken soup in the studio. He spills the chicken soup all over the console in the studio, totally ruins it, and has to have it replaced. And Phil Boyce, the program director at the time, took it out of his pay. He made it so that and it was expensive. I think you're talking about a $5,000 piece of equipment. Steve had to pay for that console being ruined by that chicken soup. So I'm all for zero tolerance when it comes to this stuff. 800-848-9222. I'll get to your calls in just a minute. But speaking of food and drink, I do want to remind you, if you haven't already done so, please give a try to Life Change Tea. I drink Life Change Tea every day. It's terrific. It's gives you a ton of energy without caffeine. It also cleanses you. It's made with a powerful herbal proprietary formula that gives you a lot of energy with no caffeine. Tastes great. Tastes like iced tea. No fillers, no GMOs. It's completely organic. It's a mild cleanse and a daily detox that cleanses you from the inside out. So because it's cleansing you from the inside out, because you get all that garbage that's in your system out of it, they call it the tea that makes you go. You can read the testimonials for yourself at getthetea.com. That's getthetea.com. And if you use the promo code Frank when you order, you will get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. That's getthetea.com. Promo code Frank. Coming up at 2:30, I'm very excited. We're going to be able to talk with Emmy-nominated television producer Michael Braverman. Michael Braverman has produced a lot of great shows, some you might be familiar with, some you might not be familiar with. Bar Rescue, which is a very popular show on the Paramount Network. All sorts of great shows. A Joe Rogan show. And he also was the producer of Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura. And he's produced some conspiracy-themed stuff over the years. And I am eager to get his take on why certain conspiracies get a lot of attention and why others hardly get any attention. So we'll talk about that. But first, I have to play this for you. I got such a kick out of this. Boris Johnson, who I think might be my favorite world leader these days, not only for the kinds of things he's doing in terms of demonstrating leadership, but because the guy is just such a character. I love his whole outlandish view of everything. I really like Boris Johnson. Since he's become prime minister, I've gotten to like him more and more. In fact, I just ordered, just because I was so taken with Boris Johnson's comments at the UN General Assembly yesterday, I just ordered one of his books on Winston Churchill. So I am looking forward to reading that. I haven't read it before, but I feel like I kind of owe it to Boris because he's providing so much entertainment to me and even occasionally information. So he's speaking before the UN General Assembly yesterday, and he gave what I thought was, and in some ways this goes back to our earlier discussion of Ken Burns saying this is the worst time in American history, on par with World War II, Civil War, and the Great Depression. And the implication is that at least part of the reason that that's the case is because of the climate crisis. So Boris Johnson was speaking at the UN yesterday, the UN General Assembly, and he talked about the climate crisis, but he did so in what I found to be a very creative way and a very humorous way. This was British Prime Minister Boris Johnson yesterday.
And when Kermit the Frog sang, "It's not easy being green." You remember that one? I want you to know that he was wrong. He was wrong. It is easy. It's not only easy, it's lucrative, and it's right to be green. He was also unnecessarily rude to Miss Piggy, I thought, Kermit the Frog.
Well, first of all, I actually found Kermit to be pretty patient with Miss Piggy. I mean, haven't we all been in relationships where one person likes the other a lot more than the other person does? And given the dynamic in the Miss Piggy-Kermit relationship, I actually found Kermit pretty tolerant. But I'm just thinking of all these delegates at the UN General Assembly listening through an Arabic translation or a Chinese translation or a Russian translation or a Spanish translation, and you hear Kermit the Frog. And I'm just picturing how these delegates are reacting, because no one laughs. If you noticed, at least there was no audible laughter when he was talking about Kermit the Frog. And I'm just trying to picture Boris Johnson on his way to the United States thinking, this is going to be the speech that everybody pays attention to. This is what I'm going to be known for around the globe. I'm going to throw a Kermit the Frog reference in there. And the UN ambassador from Haiti or Bahrain is really going to be impressed with that. I thought it was very funny, and I had to play it. All right. Coming up next hour, we are going to do a lot of interesting things. Can a governor coach a basketball team and still be an effective governor? How about this one? Can a governor coach two basketball teams and still be an effective governor? I know it sounds strange. It's in the news. We're going to comment on it, and we'll talk conspiracies with Michael Braverman at 2:30. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Until next hour, help control the pet population. Get your dog or cat spayed or neutered.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
New York, New Yorkers, New Jerseyans, Connecticutans, Massachusettsans. What are you if you're from Massachusetts? Are you a Massachusettser? A Massachusettan? A masser? What are you? I don't know. We'll find that out. Molly's probably already hard at work looking into what someone from Massachusetts is called. Here's a question for you. No cheating and copying off our listeners listening in Virginia or West Virginia. Oh, so you're a Bay Stater if you live in Massachusetts?
A Bay Stater.
That's not a great name. I don't think I've ever been to Massachusetts, and now I know why. I always wanted to go to Massachusetts. When I was in college, it just worked out that I had something like 10 or 11 friends that all were going to college in Boston and surrounding areas near Boston and Massachusetts area. And I never got up there to see them. I was always this close. And I'm as a fan of the television show Cheers, I would like to go visit the bar there. And as a baseball fan, I would love to see Fenway Park, although not given the job the Red Sox did to the New York Metropolitans last night. But Bay Staters, come on. You guys got to come up with a better title than that. All right. Don't let me get off track here. Who is Jim Justice? Now, first of all, you want to talk about a cool name? Let's talk about a cool name. Jim Justice. That's a cool name. Is he an Old West sheriff? B, a superhero of some sort? Is he C, a professional wrestler? Or D, a fictional character in a Mark Twain novel? Well, the answer is E, none of the above. Jim Justice happens to be the governor of West Virginia. And he's pretty popular out there. He was just reelected in 2020. I think he got over 30% of the vote. Very popular out there. And he's very wealthy. I think he's the wealthiest guy in West Virginia. He's a big coal mining tycoon. And he's kind of a controversial guy. He's been hounded by all sorts of allegations of conflict of interest. He's been sued. He basically, the state constitution requires you to requires you to spend your nights at the state capitol. Instead, he was trying to sleep at his home where he lived before he was governor. He went from being a Democrat and then he switched parties while he was in office to being a Republican. But he's very popular. The voters love him. And there's a lot of problems in West Virginia. West Virginia is one of those states where COVID is just going crazy. COVID has battered the state of West Virginia very badly. There were a record number of infected people in hospitals, and there's a vaccination rate there that, in spite of a pro-vaccine campaign featuring Governor Justice's pet dog, the vaccination rate in West Virginia lags behind every state. So, why are we talking about Jim Justice? Because Jim Justice does something that most governors, I think, don't. Jim Justice coaches the girls' varsity basketball team at Greenbrier. I don't know, and I apologize to all the West Virginians listening. I don't know if it's Greenbrier or Greenbrier. I think it's Greenbrier. He coaches the girls' varsity basketball team at Greenbrier High School. And he's apparently done it for decades. And he used to coach the boys' team at this particular school. And he's trying once again to coach the boys' basketball team at Greenbrier East High School. So, why are we talking about this? Well, this week, the school board in Greenbrier County, which is 110 miles southeast of the state capitol, actually it was in August technically, they voted not to hire Governor Jim Justice to coach the boys' varsity basketball team. The governor is apoplectic. The governor is going crazy. He put out a statement. He said, other than God above and my family, I place my duties as governor above all else. All I do is work. He said this yesterday. And I love my work, and I love the people of West Virginia, especially the kids. So he said this school board, which wouldn't hire him to coach the basketball team, which he used to coach, and again, he still coaches the girls' team, committed, quote, a vile action one that was manifestly arbitrary and capricious. So the school board voted 3-2 not to hire Governor Jim Justice to coach the team. The three people that ruined his aspirations are three retirees who sit on the school board in Greenbrier County. So he wanted to coach the boys' basketball team in his spare time. He already coaches the girls' team. And essentially, the school board said no. Not because he's not a good coach. They don't believe that a governor, especially a governor of a state facing as many challenges as West Virginia is right now, can coach two basketball teams at 70 years old and still do the job necessary of being a full-time governor. So you might ask the question, why would a governor and a coal tycoon, a very wealthy guy, why would a governor and a super wealthy guy want to coach the Spartans, that's their team, while his state is struggling with all sorts of problems? You have the COVID outbreak. You have a bunch of other things. And the governor's answer is he insists that he would be good at it. So for two decades, Governor Justice has coached the girls' varsity team. They won the state championship back in 2012. For 7 years before becoming governor, he coached the boys' team too. And as he detailed in an official grievance that he filed with the state public employees board, Governor Justice led the teams to more wins than any coach in school history. But now, the issue is whether Governor Justice, a Democrat turned Republican, would be good. Excuse me. The issue is not whether he would be good at this. The issue is this something that he should really be focusing on right now? One of the school board members who voted against him, Richard Parker, told the New York Times, "I have no animosity towards the governor at all. I just don't see how he can be at both the girls' games and the boys' games and still do his job as governor." I'm curious how you feel about this. Can a governor, particularly a governor facing this kind of challenges, coach two high school basketball teams and still be up to the task of running a state? And how would you feel if this was your governor? 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. And I remember when one of my favorites, Jesse Ventura, was governor, and we're going to talk with Jesse Ventura's former TV producer, Michael Braverman, coming up in 20 minutes. But when Jesse Ventura was governor towards the end of his tenure, he was doing commentary on the weekend for the XFL Football League. And a lot of Minnesotans didn't like it. He also was the guest referee at SummerSlam, I think in 1999, if memory serves. Not looking that up. And a lot of his constituents didn't like that he would take time off to do commentary on football games and to go be a referee for a wrestling pay-per-view event. So he basically said, "No, this is what I do in my spare time." Can a governor coach a basketball team? Excuse me. Can he coach two basketball teams and still govern at the same time? And how would you feel if your governor wanted to do this? And again, if memory serves, and I could be incorrect about this, and I'll ask him about it the next time I speak with him, but Governor Dick Cody, who I thought did a great job as governor of New Jersey, I believe he coached his son's basketball team while he was governor. I could be incorrect about that. I knew he was the coach at the time that he became governor. I don't know if he stepped aside in order to be governor. I'll tell you where I come down. I think it would be very challenging to coach two basketball teams while running a state. In my own case, you know, I've been asked to manage two softball teams recently because, you know, I have some softball experience. And I have declined because this job, the job that I'm doing now, requires so much time, so much preparation, and so much dedication that I don't feel like I could do an adequate job as the coach of a softball team. So if I can't, I do have a tough time seeing how a governor would. I don't know. I don't know. Also, you have the situation where the second largest employer in the county of Greenbrier is the Board of Education. So there's some overlap. The superintendent, for instance, is also the director of entertainment for the Greenbrier Resort. A member of the school board is married to a photographer who works there. So the governor has been involved with Greenbrier East basketball for much longer than he has owned the resort. He owns that resort, the Greenbrier Resort. Though his tenure has had a fair share of controversy. He's won plenty and is a big spending booster, and he paid to have really nice floors installed in the gymnasium, like it's an NBA arena, with his signature painted on the boards for posterity. So I'm curious how you would feel if this was your governor. Now, the governor, for what it's worth, says, I know I can do the job. At my age, I'll have to have great assistant coaches. To be perfectly honest, they'll have to do the work. I'll coach the game. Nevertheless, I love the kids. What say you? 800-848-9222. Jim is in Queens. Hello, Jim.
Hey, how you doing, Frank? How's it going?
I think it's going pretty well, Jim.
Good, good. Yeah, I played at Marquette, and I coached after playing at Marquette for years. And until you just mentioned what you said, I was against the governor coaching both teams. Until you just said that he's going to put a lot of reliability, responsibility on the coaches.
Well, that's what he's saying. That's what he's saying.
If he's coaching the games, why not? That's doable. If he's going to coach 6 days a week practice, which is what any varsity program demands, no way. But if he's going to have the coaches, the assistant coaches, who I'm sure they're very good because he has a good track record, possible. No way with practice. You've got to. It's not possible.
Yeah, well, look.
It just depends on how much the assistants are going to take on. If they're going to, assistant coaches, including when I was at Marquette, the assistant coaches ran practices oftentimes. Al McGuire wasn't even at practice many times. But and it gets done. It gets done. So I guess I'm not saying I'm on the fence. It just depends on whether, that's the game plan. Let the assistants run the practices or most of the practices, and then he can do that. Sounds like a great guy. He does. He sounds very generous and, benevolent and all that stuff. So, I think you could give him a thing. I think he has to be clearer with his job, with the people of West Virginia.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, Jim, and that's exactly what I was going to say. It really should be, in my judgment, not up to the school board to determine whether this is appropriate or inappropriate. I think it should be up to the voters,
and the voters
should be the one that says, "No, we don't want you running around coaching two basketball teams. We want you focused on the current state crises."
Yeah, There's truth to that. It's, again, being redundant, it just depends on his intent. He can't go to half the practices. He can't go to one-third of them. He can't go to practices, basically. Once in a while, maybe. But no way.
Right.
It's just too much time, too much brain power. He's going to be slipping on the one job and doing a fine job coaching. Coaching would be easy compared to being a governor. I mean, it's cake. It's easy, especially at his age and with his experience. It's, he pulls out his index cards and he knows what to do. So, yeah, you're right. It does depend on the voters, the citizens, and all the complexities of being a governor. I mean, oh, God, it must be so time-consuming.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for the call there. I'll tell you what, though. we've seen other governors do moonlighting, right? I mean, the example I gave of Jesse Ventura is probably the best known. I think Arnold Schwarzenegger made at least one film while he was governor. He might have done two. But, you have the Schwarzenegger example. But look at what happened in New York, right? We had a governor who, in the midst of a crisis, decided to take the time to write a book. Now, I had a big problem with it. I mean, I didn't think it was appropriate for the governor to write a book. And I was amazed that Governor Cuomo was able to whip out a book in the middle of supposedly working so hard on the COVID pandemic like that. Turns out what happened. We know he was using state resources and state employees to get that book written. So that's also a problem. I knew one politician in New York. I'm not going to mention his name, but he used his staffers to actually help his children with their homework. So there's always the temptation whenever you have a staff of folks that work for you. There's always the temptation to kind of use them to help you with other things. But we've seen moonlighting governors before. But for some reason, when someone writes a book or someone travels for the occasional speaking gig, that doesn't get as much attention as, say, somebody's desire to coach two basketball teams. Would you have a problem with your governor coaching two high school basketball teams? 800-848-9222. Tom is in New Jersey. Hello, Tom.
Yes. Hi, Frank. Yes, I would have a problem with that because he should be focusing on his main job as a governor. Because when you try to do more than one thing that is important to do, then you're going to be distracted and you're going to make mistakes. And the people are going to suffer. These politicians never pay the price of their mistakes. So that's why they should take their job really 100% serious and just focusing on that job. When he's off, if he's off on a Saturday and Sunday and he wants to go to a baseball game or do something personally, him and his family, that's up to him. But he shouldn't be doing coaching or something else that has to do with really focusing on the coaching and then focusing on him being governor.
Yeah, I tend to agree, Tom. Let me ask you this, though. Like I was saying with the previous conversation, should this really be a conversation or a decision, rather, that the school board makes? Or should this be a decision that his constituents make, and if they don't like it, they can vote for somebody else in 3 years?
I think his constituents should, you know, that his constituents would be, you know, that's a word that it's hard to understand what it really means. But I think when you say constituents should mean the people in your state.
All right, Tom. Hey, that's another county heard from. 800-848-WABC. Anybody okay with this? The governor said the assistant coaches would do most of the job. In some ways, I almost think that that's worse because, and again, I like that he wants to be involved. He does seem like a nice guy. He seems kind of my style of quirky. But if you're going to delegate your coaching responsibilities to some assistant coaches, then in some ways you're both shortchanging your constituents as governor because you're going to be at least partially distracted. And at the same time, you're shortchanging the basketball team. Because you're not doing everything that a head coach normally would do. So, I don't know. I have mixed feelings about it. I love that he wants to do this. I love you know, whenever politicians are able to maintain some element of regular life and interacting with regular people, and I find it keeps them from getting into this bubble mentality. But I just think that the job of governor is so demanding that to coach one basketball team, let alone two, is probably a drain on your time and your energy that I don't think you need. Let him finish his term as governor and then go coach the team. What's wrong with that? 800-848-WABC. Bob is in Queens. Hello, Bob.
Hello. I don't know. I think every good manager knows how to delegate to his subordinates. And if you can, you hire the right people and you let them do the job. And if they do the right job, it's an easy thing.
So you agree with the governor then? You don't have an issue with him coaching these two teams?
Well, it's, I mean, he is the governor of the state, and it is a demanding job, but also, you know, you need an outlet to blow off some steam, and this is a good distraction that can help to keep him grounded.
Right. What's the difference between this versus playing golf twice a week?
Right.
Well, it's a fine point, Bob. 800-848-9222. What do you think, Carol?
You know, Frank, my father was an administrator with the Board of Education, and he officiated basketball games, football games, but it was on the weekends. It was like Friday, Saturday, so it didn't affect his job. I don't know. I don't have a problem with the governor coaching one team because he probably is pretty good at multitasking, I would think. But getting involved with two basketball teams, I think that's stretching himself a little too thin.
It does seem that way, Carol, and thank you for the call. It does seem that way. I couldn't do it, and I am surprised that the governor thinks that he can do it. Does seem that way. All right. We're going to talk with Michael Braverman in just a few minutes, a little bit about conspiracies and how the media covers conspiracies. But first, if you are a waiter, a bartender, a construction worker, a teacher, or a student, chances are you've got to wear a mask all day. And wearing a mask, it's so lame. It's uncomfortable. It's difficult to breathe. If you wear a mask long enough, depending on the kind of mask that you use, it gets all wet and disgusting and probably not that effective. Well, thankfully, there is a better way, and EasyFlow USA is coming to your rescue. The EasyFlow Personal Air Filtration System. For more information, you can go to EasyFlowUSA.com. That's EasyFlowUSA.com. It pushes fresh, filtered air directly into your mask, allowing you to breathe normally and more comfortably. Easy Flow is recommended by medical professionals everywhere, and it's been tested in an FDA-approved lab to filter out 99.7% of virus and bacteria, including COVID. It makes your mask more effective, makes your mask drier, makes your mask more comfortable. See, this is a great product. If you're a very pro-mask person, then it makes your mask work even better. If you're an anti-mask person because you don't like the way it feels or you don't like the way you can breathe in it, then this alleviates that discomfort a little bit. So get yours today, EasyFlowUSA.com. That's EasyFlowUSA.com. There is bulk pricing available, and if you enter the promo code RADIO, you're going to save 20% off your purchase. Easy Flow USA, fresh air everywhere.
You're hearing things on 77 WABC.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC. The Other Side of Midnight presents.
This is Frank's Conspiracy Hour.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. Welcome to Conspiracy Hour. I'm Frank Moreno. As we look at some of the conspiracies that we've explored on this show and some of the ones that we haven't, one of the things that's so incredibly important is the role that the media plays in giving life to these conspiracies, in terms of spreading the word about some of these conspiracy theories, or in some cases, when necessary, debunking these conspiracy theories. And a gentleman who knows all too well the power of the media when it comes to various conspiracy theories is Michael Braverman. He's an Emmy-nominated TV producer. He's produced a whole bunch of different TV programming on CBS, the History Channel, Spike, the Paramount Network, Sci-Fi, a whole bunch of others, including Conspiracy Theory with Jesse Ventura, who we were speaking about earlier. Michael, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
Hi, Frank. Thanks for having me.
So, Michael, when I mentioned conspiracy theory to Governor Ventura a couple of years ago when he was on the show, and I mentioned to him that a couple of kind of rank and file members of the public, they said to me essentially in words or substance that, you know, I used to really like that Jesse Ventura, but then he got so into these conspiracy theories, it became tough to take him seriously. I'll ask you the same question I ask him. Do you feel like his involvement in a show dedicated solely to conspiracy theories diminished his credibility at all?
Yeah, I do somewhat with the mainstream media. I'll tell you something about Jesse, having known him for many, many years and respecting him tremendously. Governor Ventura cannot lie. He is incapable of lying. I mean, you could hold a gun to his head and you could say, Governor, I need you to tell a lie. And he would say, well, just make sure you have good aim so I don't suffer when you shoot me. He can't. He won't. And it's like he is constitutionally incapable of lying, which has been proven, by the way, in several lawsuits.
Yeah.
So that said, and the tremendous respect that I have for him, it definitely has in some ways cost him with mainstream media and with people who don't believe that there is any truth behind the reality that we see. So sure, those people, skeptics and debunkers, and some of them, by the way, I agree with on certain of the conspiracies. But there are other ones that we looked at that, as one of the executive producers of the show, along with the governor, I am convinced are real. 9/11 is not one of them, which will create a lot of angry, probably, callers to the show. And Jesse would disagree with me if he were here, because he believes in his heart that it absolutely was. But again, just to reiterate, the incredible respect I have for his integrity goes a long way, in my opinion, toward bolstering his reputation.
Are people that tend to buy into conspiracy theories, and a lot of folks buy into multiple conspiracy theories, whether it's JFK, whether it's UFOs, whether it's you name it, are people that tend to believe in conspiracy theories any more or less intelligent from your perspective than people that don't?
I think it's a good cross section. There are a lot of amazingly intelligent people that we've spoken to during the course of the show that clearly have well-honed brains and brains and minds that are working quite well, which doesn't really mean anything one way or the other. I don't think intelligence is necessarily a marker. I think some people get obsessed with conspiracy theories because there's an old joke. There's an old line that religion is just a cult plus time. So, you know, there's a lot of people who want to believe that they have the received truth, that they have the holy writ, that they know what's up and you don't. And so there's a lot of that. There's, you know, there are people who want to feel important. There are people who want to feel, once again, that they're important, you know, not only that they are important, but that they're in possession of something that is really valuable. And once again, you need to know it, meaning you, meaning editorial you, meaning us, the public. So there is a lot of that.
If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Michael Braverman. He's an Emmy-nominated producer, has done a lot of
television work on a lot of shows that you'll be familiar with. But, Michael, when I try to go to the YouTube and look for old episodes of Conspiracy Theory, the show that you were an executive producer of, I can't find any. Is that a function of big tech censorship taking the stuff down? Or is that a function of, I don't know, some debate over who owns the rights to this and who's able to put it out on the internet?
Yeah, some of them are hard to find, and I think because the show has just gotten old. But I will tell you a really creepy story that is absolutely dead true. We did an episode in the first year, first or second year, called Police State, and we got into the issue of the FEMA camps, which, you know, also have been widely debunked by most people. But we were fascinated with it, and we were fascinated with the fact that, you know what, maybe there is something coming. And, of course, in the age of COVID, it takes on sort of enhanced relevance. So anyway, we went to Congress, and I will admit I sort of fudged my way into a congressman's office and did an old style Mike Wallace attack interview. He, of course, hates me and hated me and hates Jesse. And but here's what happened. So there was a bill that never got introduced, but there was a bill that he co-sponsored that had a lot to do with, are there really FEMA camps and plans to relocate the population of the United States? He was a co-sponsor of the bill, and he said he couldn't remember. And of course, we held up a copy of the bill, and he was, you could see in his eyes, he was like, oh shit. Anyway, he called.
And just keep in mind, we're on radio there.
Michael. I'm sorry. Can I say, oh crap?
Yeah, there you go. That's better.
Okay. Anyway, so he had called the president of Turner to complain. I don't really blame him because it was kind of an attack interview. So I can't really blame him. But anyway, so he called the president of Turner, and then he read Jesse's name into the congressional record as a fearmonger and a, you know, sort of a evil conspiracy theorist. The show aired, and following its airing, it disappeared from everybody's DVRs.
Wow.
Yep. How that happened, why it happened, I couldn't tell you. I didn't even know it was possible technologically to get into people's DVRs and scrub something. But apparently it happened. And that's a really – that created a lot of sparks because people were like, how is that possible? And did this have anything to do with the Congress of the United States or the president of Turner at the time, which
wow.
isn't true.
So yeah. That is – I've never heard of anything like that. That's incredible.
Nor had we.
That is wild. Now, let me get your view based on your research and your gut instinct over something that people have been asking questions about for nearly the last 60 years, and that's the assassination of President Kennedy. Last November, on the anniversary of the assassination, we did a whole week exploring different theories as to what happened. I think we had 20 different people on giving their two cents on what they think happened. Based on your view of the situation and your research, do you think Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman? If not, what do you think happened?
I'm less interested in whether Lee Harvey Oswald was the lone gunman than I am in the people behind it. In my opinion, this is one conspiracy that I'm absolutely convinced 100% is real. We had a long debate with Vince Bugliosi, who was the Charles Manson prosecutor, who had written a 900-page book debunking all the conspiracy theories, and he and Jesse went head-to-head. It was quite heated. However, in a lot of these things, there are plenty of jagged edges. For instance, 9/11 has a lot of jagged edges. I don't believe it's enough to rise to the level of a conspiracy, but JFK is a completely different case, and I'll walk you through it as briefly as I can, if you'd like to hear it.
Please.
So in the 50s, and this will take a second, so bear with me. In the 50s, the vice president had a lot of sway at the CIA, and the vice president in the 50s was one Richard M. Nixon. He had a working group around him with some familiar names, G. Gordon Liddy, Frank Sturgis, E. Howard Hunt, very familiar names, and we'll get to that in a second. In 1962, in 61 and 62, there was the Cuban Missile Crisis and the Bay of Pigs. And we all, if we know a little bit about the Bay of Pigs, the Bay of Pigs. The CIA funded some Cuban nationalists who wanted to overthrow Castro, and they landed on a beach in Cuba called the Bay of Pigs. What isn't widely known is that there were many more CIA assets in that invasion force than is widely known. The thing failed miserably. They were pinned down on the beach, and the CIA begged President Kennedy to send in the army. He refused. And that is partly why they never forgave him. The other thing that was going on in the early 60s was Kennedy and his brother were in the process of demilitarizing the CIA and the FBI as much as possible. They became very alarmed about what Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, and they were in the process of trying to clamp down and build a fence around what these agencies could and couldn't do. That did not sit well either with the CIA. So, and I know there's theories about mafia involvement, and there's all as we all know, there's all kinds of different theories, but this is the one that I'm convinced is true. Because just like in any court case, now you have motive. You have a really serious motive, which is they believed Kennedy had betrayed them. And betrayal, as we all know, is a very motivating emotion. So now we switch to Dealey Plaza, and there are, as we all know, three tramps. And if you look at the third tramp and you put it next to the picture of E. Howard Hunt, it's the same guy. Now, remember, this was way before people even knew what a deep fake was. So we had the photos analyzed, and I know other analysts have said, no, it's not the same. But I think in this case, you kind of have to believe what your eyes are telling you. Frank Sturgis probably was the second tramp, although I'm not convinced of that, but I'm pretty convinced about E. Howard Hunt. So did Oswald act alone? Governor Ventura doesn't think so. I think you can make the case there were two Oswalds. There's all kinds of bizarre stuff, as we all know, about Oswald. He showed up at the Soviet embassy in Mexico City. He showed up at the American embassy. There's all kinds of weird stuff. But let's just pick out one weird thing. In the height of the Cold War, in 1959, this guy gets on a plane and flies to Russia. The Soviet Union. You didn't just do that for your younger listeners.
Sure.
It's the height of the Cold War. You didn't just get on a plane, fly to Geneva, and fly to the Soviet Union. He did. Next thing you know, he's working in a factory. They welcome him with open arms. He's working in a factory. He meets Marina, marries Marina, suddenly changes his mind, and flies back home without a care in the world. Once again, in the height of the Cold War, you didn't just get on a plane in the Soviet Union and fly back to the U.S. It's not that easy. Then he ends up in Mexico City, and tons of people saw him. Now, again, eyewitnesses are the least reliable source of information because perceptions change over time, and people think they saw stuff, and they remember stuff differently. So a lot of people remember this other Oswald who didn't look like Lee Harvey skulking around the Soviet embassy and the American embassy in the Mexico City. Okay, so let's leave out whether he acted alone or not. I think it's possible he made those shots. But putting that aside, what were two or even one CIA guy, what was that guy doing in Dallas in 1963 in Dealey Plaza? Well, was he overseeing the operation? I think he was. In 2007,
this guy being Howard Hunt,
E. Howard Hunt. Yeah. And again, if I'm this is taking too long.
No, no, please
stop
me.
But it's a tale that sort of winds around. In 2007, Howard Hunt's son, whose name is St. John Hunt, there was a front page article in Rolling Stone in which St. John brought forth some papers that his father had signed and a deathbed confession on audio tape by his father, this might have been in the late 80s when he was dying. Now, St. John Hunt, he may not be the most squeaky clean of all people. He's had his issues. He's had some drug issues. But nonetheless, he came forward with this. No other media outlet in mainstream media picked this up. Now, you would think a front page story in Rolling Stone implicating E. Howard Hunt in the assassination of JFK would make news somewhere, but it didn't. It ran in Rolling Stone and then disappeared. There's other reasons perhaps for that. Howard Hunt's second wife claims that St. John was doing this for money, that he put his father up to it. E. Howard Hunt himself sued multiple outlets, and maybe that's the reason the story didn't run, for claiming not about the assassination, but for claiming that he some other funny stuff about Watergate. Ah, and speaking of Watergate, so now we flash forward to 1972. It's June of 1972. The election is in November. Richard Nixon has the election in the bag. Every poll in the United States corroborated this. He was going to win by a landslide over George McGovern, who might have been the weakest candidate the Democrats had ever put forward. And as it turned out, as you know, McGovern only won one state, and that was Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So everybody knew Nixon had this election won going away. Suddenly, in June, a bunch of these guys break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters in the Watergate. Some very familiar names: E. Howard Hunt, Frank Sturgis, a couple of Cuban refugees, and G. Gordon Liddy. So what were they doing there? Now, Nixon was clearly a very paranoid person, but what on earth did he and Haldeman and Ehrlichman think that the DNC had that was worth staging a burglary? What? It makes no sense. And yes, circumstantial evidence is circumstantial, but when you have enough of it, I think it begins to add up. What were they looking for? Nixon believed that DNC had documents linking him to the assassination of JFK. That's what he believed. Mm. And that is what fomented the Watergate burglary. That's what it was all about.
And in Oliver Stone's film, Nixon, that is one of the scenes that's deleted, is him the head of the CIA at the time making allusions to exactly what you're describing. So it's pretty interesting. We're talking with Michael Braverman, Emmy-nominated producer, been involved in a lot of different television projects over the years, including something called Project Bigfoot, which was an animated series for the Discovery Channel. What was Project Bigfoot, Michael? I can't say I'm familiar with that.
It was an animated series about a whole world of talking monster trucks, Bigfoot being our main star. So we had girl monster trucks and we had boy monster trucks, and they lived in a town called Crushington Park. It was kind of like Thomas the Tank Engine, and they, you know, we taught kind of lovely lessons about cooperation.
Yeah, that's cool.
Being kind. Yeah, it was very sweet. It was very nice.
You mentioned the September 11th conspiracy theories a couple of times. We touched upon that a little bit in the run-up to the anniversary, the 20th anniversary of the attacks. And there were quite a few listeners and callers that believed various conspiracy theories. I know you've looked at it through your work with Jesse Ventura, and I'm sure independent of that. What's led you to believe that that wasn't a conspiracy of some sort, and that the official version of what we heard from the 9/11 Commission is the accurate one?
Sure. Several things. The first is the young guys who made the film that started it all, which was called Zeitgeist.
Oh, I thought it was Loose Change.
Loose Change. Forgive me. They've kind of come forward, one of them at least, and have kind of said, well, some of it might have been embellished. We're not sure all of it was all truthful. So that's number one. Number two is, let's apply Occam's razor. Let's look for the most logical explanation. This idea that you would have crews of people applying thermite to beams in a 110-story tower and nobody noticed it is, in my opinion, simply absurd. Now, the proponents, Architects and Engineers for Truth, their explanation is, well, they were modernizing the elevators, so these guys could have come in and out and no one would have noticed. It's impossible. It would have taken 50 people, I don't know, a month, 2 months, to put enough explosives in that building to bring it down. Somebody would have seen something. So Occam's razor dictates that we look for not the sexiest answer, but we look for the most logical answer, the most likely answer. So I have a lot of trouble believing that nobody saw that. Reason two, this idea that jet fuel doesn't burn hot enough to melt steel is just simply incorrect. A lot more was burning than jet fuel. Steel melts at about 1,000 degrees. the temperature up there was about 1,100 degrees because all kinds of other stuff was burning, paper, plastic, wood. I mean, these were infernos way beyond the heat of jet fuel. And as I mentioned, steel does melt at about 1,000 degrees. Fourth, a bunch of building engineers and guys in the physics world have figured out what happened, and they call it friction momentum. And that is, as the thing started to crumble, the friction created its own momentum and its own heat. And that would be, you know, the friction of beams collapsing on one another. And that's what created the pancake effect. And as you started to wobble in the top floors, the friction momentum, if I'm using that term correctly, I think I am, is what accelerated the pancake effect. Reason five, Building 7, which I know is very controversial. If you look at Building 7 in super slow motion, you will see the building start to wobble and sway. And you'll see it wobble and sway, and it kind of does a little more and does a little more and does a little more because of the intense heat. So it's not like that thing just came down, bang. It came down after you see this thing moving. And again, it starts swaying back and forth, and it starts to wobble. It's pretty obvious in super slow-mo. So those are just some of the reasons why now, if the governor was on, he would fight with me for 5 hours.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Why do some conspiracy theories end up getting a lot of attention and a lot of airtime? The one that comes to mind most immediately these days is the UFO, the various conspiracy theories involving UFOs. And then others, they get significantly less airtime on mainstream television. What's the secret sauce in what makes a conspiracy theory worthy of mainstream media coverage or not?
That's a really interesting question. First of all, UFOs are much sexier than, you know, government conspiracies, and it's just cooler, and people love to talk about it, and people love to speculate about it. It's just more fun. I'll give you an example, and this is why Governor Ventura hated stuff like UFOs, because he felt that it sucked credibility away from the more important ones that we were dealing with, especially in the first 2 years. An example would be the water conspiracy, which is, in my opinion, sort of an amazing show that we did, and there's a lot of heat about this being real, but it's more fun to talk about UFOs. So I think that's one of the reasons it happens. I've looked for UFOs with the Joe Rogan show. We've been to the UFO highway called Skinwalker Ranch in northern Utah. I've been everywhere. I've talked to everybody, very normal, sane, linear thinking people who have seen UFOs, but magically nobody has their iPhone. Or their iPhone's out of batteries. And, you know, as Joe Rogan said, just one piece of evidence, one tiny little piece of real evidence, and I'll be a believer. But I have not found it. Although, again, weird stuff happened to us doing some of these things. All kinds of weird stuff happens. I have not seen one.
I'm almost out of time, Michael, but let me end with this. You mentioned Joe Rogan, and you produced his show for Sci-Fi, Joe Rogan Questions Everything. Yeah. He's sort of become a larger-than-life media personality. Some people have compared him to this generation's Johnny Carson. Is Joe Rogan cancel-proof? He seems to be able to say the kind of controversial things and do the kinds of controversial things that a lesser media personality would find themselves on the outside looking in for.
God, I hope so, Frank, because I'm as much of a free speech absolutist as you'll find. So I hope he continues to say anything he wants to say for his platform, because we certainly need people who are not afraid to speak up, whether we agree or disagree with them.
And
in Governor Ventura's era, as you mentioned at the top of the show, that got him in some hot water.
That is for sure. Michael Braverman, I appreciate the time this morning. I hope we can talk again soon.
My pleasure. Thank you.
If you want to comment on any portion of our conversation, give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
It's a beautiful morning. I think I'll go Well, so far it is a nice morning out there, just like the Rascals are singing about. Rumor has it we may get some rain today. We'll find out when we chat with Juliet Huddy in the 5 o'clock hour. But as of now, pretty nice outside. Nice night for a peaceful walk outside. I am a guy that loves a good walk around this time, especially in a place like Manhattan. You talk about a place that's always buzzing and always busy and there's always so much noise. To be able to experience it around this time when things are substantially quieted down is, I think, a pretty special thing. It really is, as far as I'm concerned. All right. I want to talk to you about Trinity Rehab. I'm going to take your calls in a minute. Those of you who are holding will get to you. But Trinity Rehab is a tremendous resource for any of you that are suffering with chronic pain. It's not your father's physical therapy. It's cutting edge and it's state of the art because they have something called the EPAP machine. It's something that's FDA approved. It's non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue. It enhances healing. It gets rid of pain fast. Shoulder tendonitis, tennis elbow, plantar fasciitis, neck pain, shoulder pain, knee pain. The EPAP machine laughs at all that. And in just 3 5-minute sessions with the EPAP machine, you could be virtually pain-free. No prescription needed to get started. They're all over New Jersey. If this sounds good to you, if you're in pain and you don't want to be, give them a call. 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977, or you can go to trinity-rehab.com. That's trinity-rehab.com. Those of you that are holding, I don't want to rush you through a call now and give you 30 seconds to make your point. So hold on until the top of the hour, and then we'll take your calls. And then at 3:30, we'll do the AC report with Harry Hurley, one of my favorites, and somebody that I'm looking forward to chatting with about what's happening in New Jersey, Atlantic City, and the country as a whole. Until next hour, in the words of the great Barry Barber, keep asking questions. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. I read a couple of interesting stories this week. I read interesting stories every day because, I mean, that's most of what I spend the day doing, just reading. And I never get to read as much as I like, not as many articles, not as many books. I just, if I could do one thing, it would be to manage my time better so that I could read more. And I read two interesting articles this week. One was from a publication called Road and Track, and it was an interview with Ralph Nader. And Ralph Nader talked about his book, the book that put him on the map, Unsafe at Any Speed, which he details the problem with the Chevy Corvair, and he really, really changes the face of the auto industry from 1965 onward. And what I guess I knew but didn't recall is that that experience, that book, Unsafe at Any Speed, was inspired based on Ralph Nader's experiences hitchhiking. Ralph Nader would hitchhike everywhere. He, according to this interview, he must have hitchhiked 150,000 miles. He was once picked up by a truck driver in Delaware who asked Ralph what he was doing. He told him he was going to Washington, D.C. to regulate GM. Only Ralph Nader. So he hitchhiked 150,000 miles. The other interesting story that I read this week, because you can't get around it, is this Gabby Petito story. And a woman told Good Morning America that she picked up Brian Laundrie, who's a person of interest in Gabby Petito's disappearance and subsequent murder, and he's missing himself now. She picked him up as a hitchhiker and described him as being in a hurry. And it got me thinking, and again, I'm surprised that this thought has not occurred to me before, but one of my favorite books is The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. And yet, I have an adventurous spirit. I've often been out of gasoline. I like to explore. I like to have different adventures. I have never been hitchhiking. Hitchhiking, I think everybody knows, is a means of transportation that is gained by asking individuals, generally strangers, for a ride in their car or their vehicle. The ride is usually, but not always, free. Nomads, and you might have seen the movie Nomad with Frances McDormand that did very well at the Oscars this year. Nomads have also used hitchhiking as a primary mode of travel for the better part of the last century, and they continue to do it to this day. Now, I think hitchhiking, and I'm not an expert on this, and I don't pretend to be, I think hitchhiking is technically illegal. I don't think you're allowed to stand on the side of a major highway and solicit rides. I think there's some concern that there's a danger. This could be a danger to the other drivers on the road and to the passengers. But I think you are allowed, and if somebody knows better, please correct me. I think you are allowed to stand at the on-ramp entrance before a highway in most states. And it just got me thinking, have you been hitchhiking? Have you ever gone hitchhiking? Have you ever picked up a hitchhiker? What was your experience? 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. I've never picked up a hitchhiker. The closest I've been to this, and this has happened to me many times, is I'll see a friend of mine or somebody I know, even if they're not a friend, somebody I know, waiting for the bus or something like that, and I'll be in my car and I'll wave to them, hey, David, hey, Charlie, hey, Mike, come on in, where are you going? I gotcha. And I'll drive them to wherever they're going if we happen to be going in the same direction. I've done that many times. That's not hitchhiking. I have never, ever picked up a person who's standing there on the side of the road with their thumb out and taking them along the road with me. There is, you know, I don't know what the statistics say in terms of crime committed towards and from hitchhikers, but there's always a little bit of a reluctance about putting a perfect stranger in your car. And if you're the hitchhiker, maybe there's some reluctance in getting in a car with someone who you've never met. But I am curious if you've been hitchhiking or if you've picked up a hitchhiker, what your experience has been, because I'm wondering if this is one of those things that I should do. Not routinely, but I feel like it's one of those things that I should do at least once. I don't want to use the term bucket list because we did a whole bucket list show and it's got me thinking about that term in a whole new way. But I'm wondering, wouldn't it be fun, for instance, to hitchhike to Albany or hitchhike to upstate New York? I wouldn't hitchhike across the country. That's a bit much. But you take a week and you hitchhike from the southernmost point in New York, happens to be Staten Island, to upstate New York. I think there could be some fun to that. You go and explore the towns that you go to. You stop at the rest stops. You meet some interesting people, experience the local culture. I think it might be fun. Maybe, you know, we're going to do the AC report in at 3:30. I wonder what it would be like to hitchhike to Atlantic City. That would be a struggle because a lot of that is just highway. But I do wonder, have you ever been? 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Mike in Manhattan. Hello, Mike.
Hello. It's Mike in Manhattan here.
Excellent.
Okay, well, I hitchhiked when I was in college. Like now that's like 45 years ago, longer. It's like, let's say in the mid-70s. I was going to New Paltz College. And there, hitchhiking, it was like hippie land, you know, kind of thing. It was Ulster County, and And it was all these hippie kids from Long Island used to go to school there. And it was just hitchhiking was common. And I used to have my grandparents lived in Dutchess County. It was across the Hudson on the other side of the Poughkeepsie Bridge from Newport. So I used to hitchhike back and forth there. Also, when my father would go to my grandparents' house, he would pick up hitchhikers. It was something that was done in the mid 70s. It's one of those Americana things that doesn't exist anymore, like hobos riding on, you know, freight trains. It just isn't done anymore. You know.
So, well, why isn't it done? Let's start with that.
Was that?
Why isn't it done anymore?
Well, I think there is the danger issue that is many of the serial killers in the 1970s would pick up hitchhiking girls at college towns of all things. And then they would find their mutilated bodies in shallow graves. So that kind of thing basically stopped. Also, I mean, I've heard horror stories from women.
Right. So have I. And, you know, it's so difficult to know. And thanks for the call, Mike. It's so difficult to know what's reality and what's media hype. Like how likely were you to get murdered by a serial killer and dismembered if you're a hitchhiker versus a member of the general population? Is that one of those things that the media highlighted so everyone thought hitchhiking was more dangerous? Or is hitchhiking actually dangerous because you're riding in a car with a perfect stranger or you're picking up a perfect stranger who could rob you or do something else? 800-848-9222. Gina Marie, have you ever been hitchhiking?
Hello?
Gina Marie, go ahead. Have you ever been hitchhiking?
Okay. First of all, I wanted to say congratulations on the baby.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, yeah. In 1976, I was 20 years old, and my best friend and I, she was 18, we decided to hitchhike from New York to New Orleans. Okay, so we went to the library and researched this was before the internet. We researched the maps, you know, the highways that we would have to go to, you know, to go down there, and we took off. We had $500 with us and suitcases and everything, duffel bags. Not a lot of suitcases, a couple of duffel bags. And we started out. This was in November 1976. So we started out in New York, and we made our way, and we went down there. It took us 4 days to get down there, and the only ones who picked us up were truckers, believe it or not.
That sounds like so much fun.
The only ones who would pick us up were truck drivers, and they were like, breaker, breaker, we got a couple of puppies in the cab.
it only took you guys 4 days?
4 days, and we stayed in a hotel in Knoxville, Tennessee, just to break the monotony of the hitchhiking, and nothing happened to us, nothing bad happened to us. You can't do something like that nowadays.
Well, why, Gina Marie? Why do you think we can't do something like that nowadays?
With the state the thing to going in? I don't know. I mean, my daughter says to me, why didn't you just take a plane? I said, because we wanted to have an adventure.
No, exactly. That's what I'm saying. And I'm wondering if maybe it says something about the country that we've gotten away from that adventurous spirit. Because I'm listening to what you're describing. It sounds like a lot of fun. And believe it or not, crime, especially random acts of crime, is actually much less now than at the time that you did that in the 1970s. 800-848-9222. That's something. Hitchhike from New York to New Orleans. See, that sounds fun. And it only took 4 days. Wow. Gary is in New Jersey. Gary, you've ever been hitchhiking?
Oh, yeah, Frank. In the 60s, it was pretty normal for little teenagers to go up, like, you know, from the city up to maybe the like South Orange area, and we would hitchhike, you know, go fishing and all that. But then,
seventies,
things, you know, the Vietnam War was, and it changed a little bit. But you had different types of people, and you went hitchhiking, and people went hitchhiking, and you'd pick up people with instruments, you know. Because it was what was going on.
Why do you think it changed? Why do you think it stopped?
Well, it changed because in the 60s, the police didn't really enforce it because they didn't have a lot of crimes with it. But as the times went past, there was, like the other caller said, there was more killings and this and that. And they were giving out tickets. The cops would start giving out tickets because it was starting to become an issue in law enforcement.
And, I see. So it was a reflection mostly of law enforcement cracking down on what was previously something they'd turn a blind eye to.
Yeah, I think so. And because it got real out of hand with when the world started changing, and you had more of these people attacking hitchhikers, they pick them up and, you know, this and that. So the friendly people were gone, and now you had a different breed of Americans, you know?
Interesting. Gary, what was the farthest place you ever hitchhiked?
I didn't really hitchhike that much. When we were kids, we did, because to go fishing. It was only like maybe 10, 15 miles, 10 miles maybe, to go fishing up in the pond up out of the city, because we grew up in Vailsburg, you know, in Newark. And we'd have to go up to South Orange to get some country, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. No, I get it, Gary. Thank you. Patrick in Huntington, you actually hitchhiked across the country?
Oh, tomorrow, Frank. How you doing?
Great.
Well, I grew up on North Shore, Long Island. And so I was like 15, 14, 15, 16 in the mid-70s. And we really didn't have much transportation as far as buses, you know what I mean? So it was a way of life for everybody in the whole town in the Huntington, Northport area. I mean, if you wanted to go down in the village, put your thumb out. It was just a way of life. That's how we got around. Until someone was old enough, you know, 16, got their license, then kind of things changed. But when we were, you know, really in our youth, we that was the mode of transit. And everybody picked you up, too. You know, I hitchhiked to school every day.
Do you agree with the previous callers that the reason it changed and people stopped hitchhiking was the combination of publicity about these crimes committed against hitchhikers coupled with police cracking down on hitchhikers?
Yeah, that's a tough question to ask. I mean, the cops, when a cop used to pass us, we just put our thumb back and turn around, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There wasn't much crime, you know? Well, so yeah, why did it stop? Yeah. I don't know. I think maybe society just got more suspicious of everybody, you know? Maybe with the young kids, don't pick up strangers. You know, maybe they listened, you know. Could be. I don't know if the crime was that prevalent with hitchhikers, though, was it?
I don't think so. And again, yeah. I'm going to do a little research, Patrick. But I think it's one of those things where you heard about the crimes, but I think the part of the reason it got so much publicity was because it was actually relatively rare to have a hitchhiker murdered or something. Let me ask you this, Patrick, not that you need to, because it sounds like you might have a car these days, but would you feel comfortable hitchhiking these days?
Me, myself, unless I was totally stranded and, you know what I mean, and in some kind of predicament, maybe, yeah, I would be hesitant if someone pulled over. I wouldn't be hesitant.
All right. Well, that's good to know, Patrick. I'm thinking about doing it, and so far I don't see any reasons why I shouldn't. 800-848-9222. Let's say hello to the original Rick in New Jersey. Hello, Rick.
Hey, good morning, Frank. Yeah, I was one of the original hippies, and so that was a mode of transportation. And I used to live out in the desert. So there was a lot more out in the west, I think, than the east. I don't know, maybe just because I lived out there. But not all the things that, you know, like we've been hearing about all these dire things, people getting killed on that. But some of it's lighthearted. Like what I used to do, I'd see them way up the road. You know, you could see miles up the road. I'd see them hitchhiking. So what I would do is roll up my windows and turn on the heat. And it would be so hot in there, but I'd be coming up, and these guys, you'd see them, a big smile because they thought they had a car with air conditioning, which wasn't always common out there. And they open the door, jump in, and I take off, and they realize it's like 120 in there. And they go, it's kind of hot in here. And I go, oh, no, it's wonderful. Don't you love it? And eventually they go, all right, listen, you got to let me out. You got to let me out. And then I'd roll down the windows and laugh and say, no, we're and
that's pretty funny. That's very funny, Rick. Would you feel comfortable picking up a hitchhiker today?
No.
Why?
Because, well, people weren't carrying guns on them all the time. And first of all, I'm an old white guy, so now I'm the target, you know? No, I wouldn't. Frank, it's a different world. It was, you know, people give you the peace signs in the old days. And like, you know, it just isn't, you know, and not only that, but with Uber and all that, you wonder why are they hitchhiking? You want to hitchhike for fun, you know, but a lot of people figure this is just a way to get in your car.
Right. Well, that's true. But again, you say it's a different world. In terms of random crime and theft and murder and assault, it's actually much safer than it was in the late 70s and early 80s.
Yes. But I don't think it is when you're alone. I think that safety thing is when in crowds and all that, it's much safer. But I think when you're look what just happened with, you know, this Gabby and all that. They're alone when this happens. I mean, things happen much worse when you're alone.
Well, again, the Gabby Petito situation, I don't think is analogous because I think what
there's no. But my point is when things happen when there's no one around a lot more than when there's people are around. And unfortunately, when you're hitchhiking in the middle of nowhere, there's nobody around.
Right. But I think that was also true in the 70s. I think a crime was much more likely if you're alone than if you're with a group of people. I think for some reason people's perception of this has changed from the 70s, and I don't necessarily think it's borne out by the data. Rick, thank you for the call. 800-848-9222. We're going to be talking with Harry Hurley in about 10 minutes. Get an update on all things Atlantic City. He's got a big event coming up next Friday. I'm going to be there. And a couple of WABC favorites are going to be there as well. We'll tell you who. Let me say hello to Tom in the Boogie Down Bronx. Hello, Tom.
Yeah, I can give you some statistics on the hitchhiking. I read an article one time that it's dangerous for the hitchhiker, and it's dangerous for the individual picking him up. There was a guy that used to go around picking up hitchhikers, and he was a sadistic character. He had a gun behind the seat, the passenger seat, and when they sat down on the seat to get in, the gun would go off and the individual would be dead. And he killed X amount of individuals doing it that way. It's also bad for individuals picking people up because there are individuals, sadistic individuals, that will kill you for the automobile. Today, there are so many auto thefts going on. Auto thefts are real big now. Remember the time I told you that the guy that was in I was in the gasoline station, the guy tried to steal my car, only that I kept my driver's side closed. He couldn't open the door. Then he ran off. That tells you something, you know.
Yeah, well, Tom, I don't think those are statistics. I think those are anecdotal examples, and there is a big difference between the two. We're going to chat with Harry Hurley about Atlantic City in just a few minutes. But first, let me say hello to Richard in Paterson, New Jersey, who's been very patiently holding. Hello, Richard. What's on your mind?
Hi. How you doing, Frank?
Good.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have one story. It's not related to hitchhiking, although I have one for that, but relating to aliens. Back in 88, I brought two of my friends back from Rahway toward Paterson, and on the turnpike, 100 cars had pulled over, and they were all out looking up in the air. So I pulled over out of curiosity to see what they were all looking at, and we looked up, and it was a giant saucer going from New Jersey by the airport, Newark Airport, all the way over toward New York, and then back over toward Jersey. This thing was huge. It had to be about 8 city blocks square and about as high as, you know, one of the highest buildings around. And it started going up the Hudson. No one had cameras back then. It was back in 88. And we'll all just stand there stunned. So I hopped in my car. I said, let's follow this thing. And it goes flying up the Hudson. And I went flying up in my car. It went a little faster. I got up to 130 miles an hour and couldn't go any faster. And that thing just passed me like I was standing still.
And to prove the story, I went to work the next morning in Fort Lee, and my boss and his wife lived on the Hudson. And this thing was up there about 9:30 over their house, coming down with the landing gears down. And they said, well, I can go look at it. And the landing gears went back up, and the thing took off. And we matched stories the next morning on the job, and we both saw the same thing. I'm just wondering how come those other 100 people have never mentioned it anywhere.
Well, so that's what I was going to ask you, and you broke up a little bit towards the end there. So if 100 or so people were all out of their cars looking at this, why do you think there wasn't media coverage of it? Why wasn't it in the papers or on the local news or something?
Well, I called Cedarville Airport. They said it's probably a little planes flying around in formation.
But you don't buy that?
Oh, no. No way in the world.
Interesting.
One big solid object. As you can see, I could see people walking up in the windows. That's how low it was.
Wow. That is some story. That is some story, Richard.
It's like aliens.
Hey, I buy it. I believe it. Thank you, Richard. 800-848-9222. We're going to talk with Harry Hurley in just a moment. He is an expert on all things Atlantic City, all things New Jersey. He actually, before he was on the radio, he's a radio talk show host now. Before he was on the radio, he was a casino executive for the Trump Organization. He actually worked for Donald Trump, if you can believe it. All right. Speaking of things that are profitable, which gambling occasionally can be, not in the long run, but usually once in a while it can be. Legacy Precious Metals has some answers for you on how to navigate the current inflation problem. Inflation is skyrocketing. And that means if your money is sitting in a traditional retirement account, you are seeing it eaten away right under your nose. Think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA, and think about doing it with Legacy Precious Metals. The last time the stock market collapsed and Americans lost their retirement, those that were invested in gold saw big gains and avoided the financial carnage. That's why gold really should be a part of every wise investor's portfolio. Legacy is the company that you can trust because they give you unbiased information based on your individual situation. Contact Legacy Precious Metals today. Call 866-932-0635. Write this number down, please. That's 866-932-0635. Or you can visit them online at legacypminvestments.com.
You're hearing things on 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC. This is the AC Report.
Chicken man in Philly last night, and they blew up his house too. Down on the boardwalk, they're ready for a fight. Gonna see what them racket boys can do. Now there's trouble busting in from out of state, and the DA can't get no relief. Gonna be a rumble on the promenade, and the gambling commissioner's hanging on by the skin of his teeth. Everything dies, baby, that's a fact. But maybe everything that dies someday he comes back. Put your makeup on, fix your hair up pretty, and meet me tonight in Atlantic City.
Good morning, everyone. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano. Every week, we take a look at what's happening In America's Playground, in Atlantic City, in Monopoly City, one of the most interesting cities in the state, the city, in the country, quite frankly, probably the world. And I'm going to be in Atlantic City a week from Friday. I'm going down there for this terrific charity event that I go down there every year for. Happens to be hosted by our guest this morning. He's an expert in many different areas. He's a radio talk show host on WPG. You can occasionally hear him filling in on this radio station for Brian Kilmeade. Also, before he was on the radio, happens to be a former Trump casino executive. And before all that, he is somebody that I'm proud to call a friend, Harry Hurley. Harry, thanks so much for joining me on the radio.
Frank, great to be with you.
Harry, it's going great. I want to ask you about what's happening in Atlantic City, and I want to ask you about your event next Friday. But you are an astute observer of New Jersey politics, North Jersey, South Jersey. You know what's happening in Jersey. What's going on with the New Jersey governor's race? I've been hearing Jack Cittarelli be very vocal, doing a lot of radio interviews. He certainly seems to be giving Governor Phil Murphy an energetic challenge. How do you see that playing out?
I always default to New Jersey has such an overwhelming number of Democrat registrations versus Republican registrations. However, Governor Tom Kaine won twice. Christy Whitman won twice. Chris Christie won twice. It's almost like clockwork that every other election cycle, the Republican does, in fact, win. Not for U.S. Senate, never. Not for 50 or 60 years. But for governor. And we don't even have time to go into the idiosyncrasies of that. But I have a theory about that, that the Washington stuff is just abstract, and they don't even think of those as New Jersey representatives. They sort of look at senators as national representatives. Here in New Jersey for governor, though, every other election cycle, and sometimes it's two terms and then the next go round it switches. So if what's been going on for 40 years continues, Cittarelli will be governor. I think there's a little bit of a difference, though. Chris Christie, very well known. If you remember, Christy Whitman gave then United States Senator Dollar Bill Bradley all he could handle, and she made a huge name for herself. She had only been the chair of the Board of Public Utilities, someone that nobody knew, but she came so close to knocking off Bill Bradley that she was then perched to do very, very well. I think the problem, and he's a dear friend, and he's a great guy, and he's electable probably in many states around the country. Jack Cittarelli, it takes, as you know, New Jersey, very densely populated, more than 9 million people, very, very hard to get that statewide name recognition. So Cittarelli is spending the entire primary election, the entire general election, just getting name recognition. However, having said that, he's got a shot. He's got a fighter shot. Who was it? Mike Tyson that said everybody has a plan until you punch them in the face.
Right.
Cittarelli has a shot. Remember now, if we poll the state, most people can't even pronounce his name. It gets butchered. So if they don't even know your name, you've got a big hurdle, you know, to get over, big hill to climb. He's got a shot. All the polls are tightening. I think it's going to be a byproduct. How's that pandemic going to be doing? Are there any new variants right before the people are going to the polls? Any new mandates that people are just completely disgusted with? You got, if you're being intellectually honest, Murphy is going to be tough to beat. But Cittarelli is, he's in the game.
Well, it's certainly going to be interesting. I think we're in the home stretch now in New York's mayoral election, New Jersey's statewide election. It's going to be interesting to see what twists and turns emerge between now and Election Day. How are things going in Atlantic City? I know even at its worst, at its nadir, Atlantic City always did very well during the summer. And then things, depending on the season, tended to wane at once fall comes around. What's going on in Atlantic City now? How are things looking economically, culturally, and what sense do you get kind of about the spirit of the city these days?
Good question. Great question, actually. What a lot of people either forget or don't know in the first place, the Atlantic City gaming jurisdiction is the third largest casino jurisdiction in the world, not in the country, in the world. Let's start there. So it's huge. Even with a few less casinos, even with the Great Recession and everything else, the pandemic, many would be shocked to hear, maybe not your audience, because you do such a great job on the other side of midnight with Frank Morano covering Atlantic City, really like unlike any other host in America. You do a great job. Now,
thank you.
Yeah, it's true. I'm not just blowing smoke. I mean, you earn that comment because you do a great job. The Atlantic City market right now having a record summer from a revenue standpoint. Now, in fairness, in days gone by, 40 years ago, we didn't have legalized sports betting. We didn't have the internet capability to do what so many people are now doing. So the bricks and mortar are down. That's understandable because there's so many other ways to gamble besides, you know, what some call bricks and sticks or bricks and mortar. But we are having a record revenue in the history of the jurisdiction. Atlantic City has never made more money than it's making right now. And I think that would surprise a lot of people.
I think you're right. And is that wealth or that infusion of money in Atlantic City, is that trickling down to smaller businesses in Atlantic City, local restaurants, local bars, local stores? Or is that something that only the nine casino owners are getting to enjoy the benefits of?
Yeah, fortunately, the former, not the latter, because if it was, then that would be a terrible thing. A lot of it would go to the state. A lot of it would just go to the individual properties, and then there would be no residual benefit or direct benefit. Remember, a lot of people supply their wares and their supplies to the industry. They do phenomenal. We have more people. I've said this on your show before. We have more people that come to Atlantic City every year than Disney World's The Magic Kingdom. So it's huge in terms of opportunity. The local restaurants are booming, like in New York, like almost everywhere in America. We have restaurants, Frank, actually, that have to close one or two days a week because they don't have the staffing to cover, whether it be a chef or service staff or food preparation staff. I mean, iconic restaurants that you know and you've dined at that are closed 2 days a week. Atlantic City is booming right now, and the local community and the surrounding local communities are benefiting.
Well, that's certainly encouraging to hear. And if people haven't visited Atlantic City in a while, or maybe not ever, I don't think there's ever a better time to go than this time of year. You still got nice weather. You can walk the boardwalk. You can maybe even spend time on the beach, but it's not oppressively hot. And the crowds thin out a little bit so that you can go to restaurants and go to play at a casino and go to a show and not be inundated with hordes of people. Harry, I saw some interesting news this week. I'm ashamed to admit it as a New Yorker and somebody that likes sushi and seafood a great deal, but I've actually never been to the Nobu here in Manhattan, but I saw that Nobu, the Robert De Niro restaurant that specializes in sushi and everything, is opening in Caesar's Palace in Atlantic City as part of their renovation. What's going on there?
Well, that's exactly what's happening, and some people like it, some people don't like it. But it's huge. I mean, for example, Mukashi Sushi Bar that you know in Resorts Casino Hotel, where we're going to be 1 week from tomorrow, where Frank is going to be in the house because you're a great friend and you've been a great supporter of our charity. This brings buzz. The De Niro name, politically unpopular with some, with many, with me. I think he's completely just stupid with the things he says and does. Notice he's been a lot more quiet now that my former boss, President Trump, is not in office. He was truly Trump.
Oh, over the top.
I mean,
over the top.
Sick. I mean, just terrible. So I think he's trying to put a lot of that behind him. And there is a lot of excitement about this.
Well, I'm looking forward to going. Do we know the timeline for this, Harry?
No, it is in the near future.
Well, that's going to be exciting. Now, before we talk about what's happening next Friday, I saw that there was this terrific event in Atlantic City at resorts where some of the first responders were honored by the CRDA, the Casino Redevelopment Association, formerly headed by the grandfather of our call screener, Molly. And, you know, in spite of his no longer being there, they're still doing some interesting things. Tell me about this event. What did the CRDA do to honor these first responders?
Well, I was there. I'm not sure if you know that, Frank. I was there for the entire event, and it was fantastic. Here's what was beautiful about it. On its face, it honored our first responders, and I have an expression we have to remember to remember them. And a lot of people don't realize it's not just the obvious. The fire department, the police department, the paramedics were there, the EMS dispatchers were there, the local Atlantic City 911 dispatchers were there, the beach patrol there, and Atlantic City Emergency Medical System, what's called EMTS. So you had all of these entities, and a lot of people don't realize first responders really ripples in a lot of different areas. You have to tell me, though, you're a staff member. Who was her grandfather that was the head? Because I had to know him. Who?
Tom Carver.
Tom Carver. We actually had him on the radio a couple of months ago.
Oh, my God. Congratulations. What a great man. He's been on our show many times, and I'm a huge fan. Matt Daugherty is now the executive director. Tom Carver is a legend. Let me just start there. But yesterday's event, beyond the beauty, and let me tell you something, it was amazing to see each fire person go up and so on and so forth, honored. The room was electric. But here's what it also was, Frank, and you will love this. Atlantic City has something that I get behind and my program gets behind every year. We have Atlantic City Restaurant Week. For 1 week, we roll back the clock. You can get 3-course lunches for $15.21. And in fact, the lunch that was served at Dougherty Steakhouse, where I know that the great Frank Morano has dined.
Oh, yeah.
It is absolutely fabulous. The famous, legendary Dougherty family that owns Knife and Fork and Doc's Oyster House and all these different things. Linwood Country Club, where we do our charity golf tournament. It was off the charts. So you're talking about a 3-course lunch for $15.21. 3-course prefix dinner menus for $35.21. So this was a combination first serve to our first responders and a kickoff to Atlantic City Restaurant Week, which more than 60 some restaurants are participating. And that takes place October 3rd through the 8th. And the town and the surrounding towns participate. And this thing just crushes it, Frank.
That is outstanding, and I am certainly going to try and take advantage of that. Now, let's talk about your charity event that I'm going to be in town for next Friday. I get invited to all sorts of things around New York, around New Jersey, and in Atlantic City, but the one of the few events that I make sure I'm at every year is your charity dinner. It's so wonderful because it's a tribute to two things that I take very seriously, one being talk radio, the other being Atlantic City. Explain to folks what your charity is and what the genesis of this event was, Harry.
And let me first thank you and Rachel, because you guys are always with us. We appreciate your support. And more importantly, we appreciate your friendship. I've been raising funds to help different schools. We would find that there would be schools that didn't have uniforms for one of their sports programs or a piece of equipment that would be needed. There was a school that was forfeiting 9 points at every track meet because they didn't have the proper mats to be able to hold the pole vault. Imagine that. I mean, in a large school, it was just crazy stuff. So we would ad hoc fundraise. About 14 years ago, I thought, I want to do more. Let's formalize this thing. Let's not just put out the clarion call once in a while and make it happen. Let's form a foundation, a charity foundation. Let's go big. And we've been able to raise over $1 million. You have contributed to it each and every year for well more than a decade. And every year we have a charity golf tournament and we have a charity dinner. Frank's been at probably 10 of the 12 that we've had, maybe more. And obviously, we couldn't have it last year with the pandemic. We did get the golf tournament in miraculously. And this year, we got the golf tournament in, and we're going to get the dinner in, which we're really happy about. And then what we do is every year we designate charities that we write grants to, hospitals, schools, food banks, literacy programs. I mean, you go on and on. We've donated to hundreds of charities over the past 14, 15 years. And the reason we're able to do it is we raise a lot of money at these two big events that we put on. And you want me to tell your listeners a little bit about what's going to be happening a week from
tomorrow? The two latest honorees I'm going to ask you to hold off on, but because they're, I think, very familiar to this audience. If people are just tuning in, we're talking with Harry Hurley. He's a radio talk show host on WPG in Atlantic City, and he's doing his big charity event next Friday. I'm going to be down there for it. And you've honored a lot of great people at this dinner in the past, and I've been there to see Bob Grant honored, Roger Stone, Brian Kilmeade, Joe Piscopo, Todd Starnes, a number of really interesting folks, and it's always a pretty special event. This year, the primary honoree is a gentleman named Tom Cantone. Now, who's Tom Cantone?
Tom Cantone is a legend, and he might be a legend that some of your listeners have never heard of. But he has booked more entertainment. He is the man that first booked Eddie Murphy. He's the man at the Sands Casino back then. He's the man that first booked Billy Crystal. He has booked more entertainment over the past 40 years than any human being on the planet. He's written a book called Book 'Em. He will be our featured guest of honor and keynote speaker. Tom Cantone is the president of sports and entertainment for what's called MGE. That's Mohegan Gaming Entertainment at the corporate level. He's a phenomenal individual. He's an inspiring speaker. He's just a tremendous person. And he will be our featured keynote speaker. And everyone that's in attendance, and we have hundreds that will be with us, are just going to love him. Everybody's going to get his book, and it'll be autographed and all of that. But that's a little thumbnail sketch of Tom Cantone. He's booked everyone from Sinatra. In fact, probably the only act he hasn't booked in the past 40 years, and there's an open invitation, they've had conversations, is Paul McCartney.
Wow.
You name anybody else, he's booked them.
So Tom Cantone, the president of sports and entertainment at Mohegan Gaming and Entertainment. You know, it's funny. I'm glad we're getting a copy of the book, because I was just online trying to buy a copy of that book so that I could get him to sign it. And I couldn't find a copy, because it sounds like a phenomenal book. And I know he's got great stories in and out of Atlantic City dealing with the Trump years and a bunch of other things. So I'm looking forward to hearing from him and getting a copy of that book.
Let me tell you one quick story. And because of the dinner, he had an opportunity to update the book. And there's some really cool things, such as 1989, I was in the house because I was blessed to be President Trump's senior hotel executive. The evening that Al Pacino and Andy Garcia, and I mean, you name them all. Of course, Carlo had to pay for Sonny, as you know. Everybody was in the house. And actually, part of the filming, the iconic helicopter scene of the boardroom of the mob dons being assassinated, that took place
in Godfather Part 3.
That is correct. In Godfather Part 3, I knew you would know, in the hotel that I ran for Mr. Trump, for President Trump. And that's in the book. You're going to love the book. And yes, it will be waiting for you, Frank, your autographed copy. We'll be waiting when you check in.
Well, terrific. Well, speaking of The Godfather, you are one of the late additions to this dinner, and my level of excitement and enthusiasm has gone from 9.5 to 12 on a scale of 1 to 10, is Johnny Russo, who's been a regular guest on this show, who played Carlo in the movie The Godfather and has just led the most interesting life of anyone I've ever met. Johnny Russo is going to be not just at the dinner, but playing a pretty big role at this dinner.
Yes, and it's not a late addition. Full disclosure and breaking news on Frank Morano, The Other Side of Midnight. He was always coming. This is almost 2 years in the making because of the pandemic. He was always coming. We just didn't reveal it.
I see.
So Tom was always the guest of honor. And there's another great guest that I'm sure we're going to talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Moment.
So
let me share something cool about Gianni Russo, though. We're going to bring him up. We have a silent auction, second to none, experiences, all kinds of amazing things. It's going to be incredible. But we're doing something we've never done before. We're going to do a live auction. I'm telling you a secret that nobody knows about yet. Gianni Russo will come up to the dais, and he will conduct a live auction. This is if you don't bid, I'm going to be so disappointed. And I know you never disappoint me. Here's what's happening. Gianni Russo, you know the home that was bequeathed to him from a legendary mobster.
Right, Frank Costello.
Correct. He's going to tell the whole story on October 1st at the Resorts Casino Hotel in Atlantic City. He has original, authentic Godfather memorabilia. We are going to limo four people. This is a silent auction for four people. We're going to limo them from wherever they are to Gianni Russo's home. Gianni is going to cook them an amazing Italian dinner, and he will regale and tell great stories and conquests about the Godfather, show them this home that once was Frank Costello's, and show them all this Godfather memorabilia, autograph his book for them. And I mean, just a once-in-a-lifetime experience that you could never get any other way than by this special invitation. How great is that going?
That is, I am pretty excited about that. I'm looking forward to that, and you can bet that I'm going to be bidding on that. Now, if that wasn't enough, you got Tom Cantone, you got a great night in Atlantic City, supporting a lot of great South Jersey charities and charities in general. You get to see me and hang out with you and see it, just to have a great time. WABC's own Tony Orlando, who is heard every Saturday night from 10 p.m. to midnight, legendary singer from dawn, knock three times, tie a yellow ribbon. Tony Orlando is going to be at this dinner.
I know. Isn't this crazy? We are so blessed to do what we do and to have the friends that we have. I mean, think about this. Any one of these guys, you could wrap an entire amazing, successful event around. We've got all three of them, and we throw Murano in there. It's four, one of the top 100 talk show hosts in America. I mean, we're blessed, and we know it. That's the important thing. We know it, and I believe that we have an obligation in this industry, and I know you operate in the same fashion, to do everything that we can to do good and to give back, to connect in our communities, and we're going to raise many tens of thousands of dollars.
It's very exciting. Tony Orlando, Johnny Russo, Tom Cantone, all in one dinner. And even though I'm only number 94 on that top 100 talk show host list, you can also see the much higher rated Harry Hurley. Most important question, Harry, if people want to go, are there still tickets available, and how do they attend? How do they purchase tickets?
Sell out, my friend. It's over. The people who are going. It's closed out. Name cards are printed. Everything's ready to go. I wish we could, but we can't.
Well, it's as Met fans are used to saying, wait till next year. It's all the more incentive to get in on the ground floor early. Harry, it is always a treat to talk with you. I am looking forward to seeing you next Friday.
Thank you, my friend.
All right. Harry Hurley, you can check him out on WPG Radio. He's one of the great talk show hosts in the country and in the region. And you can also occasionally hear him fill in for Brian Kilmeade on WABC. We'll take your calls next, 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
77.
Celebrating 100 years.
WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
The tables are empty, the dance floor's deserted. You play the same love song, it's the 10th time you've heard it. That's the beginning, just one of the clues. You've had your first lesson in learning the blues. The cigarettes you light
One after another. This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Moreno. We'll take your calls at 1-800-848-9222. Six open lines right now. We will get right to you. Coming up next hour, we have the $1,000 Minute at 4:30, where you can try and win $1,000 by answering 10 questions. And we have some other tricks up our sleeve for next hour. But I really enjoyed talking to Harry Hurley. I'm looking forward to being at that event next Friday and hopefully seeing some of you as well. Even if you're not going to the event, if you happen to be in Atlantic City, shoot me an email. I'll meet you for a drink or whatever. You can reach me through Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, or email by going to moranovision.com. That's moranovision.com. If you are on Facebook, I want to encourage you to join the Facebook group that we have set up for listeners of this show. Just go on Facebook and search Morano Radio Fans and Haters. That's M-O-R-A-N-O Radio Fans and Haters. And what that is it's a forum for people that enjoy discussing whatever's covered on this show. If you have constructive criticism, that's the place to do it. If there's things you like, that's the place to do it. If you have questions about a certain topic that I've brought up or one of the guests have brought up, that's the place to do it. Something you want to hear more on the show, that's the place to do it. Just go on Facebook, M-O-R-A-N-O Radio Fans and Haters. Meantime, if you are concerned about inflation and what it means for your financial future, you should be. Inflation is a real problem. And historically, what has always been a hedge against inflation has been gold and other precious metals. And that's exactly what Legacy Precious Metals wants to do for you and your financial portfolio. If you have your money, whether you're a current retiree or a future retiree, if you have your money sitting in a traditional retirement account, it's getting eaten away right under your nose. What can you do about it? Well, think about rolling it into a gold or a silver IRA. And if you do that, think about doing it with Legacy Precious Metals. Because the last time the stock market collapsed, people that were invested in gold made bank. Everybody else, not so much. People had their retirement accounts decimated. Don't let that happen to you. Inflation's a real problem, and unless you have some gold and other precious metals as part of your portfolio, you're going to be up the creek without a paddle. Let Legacy Precious Metals give you some guidance and some advice. They guide you based on your individual situation. They have a great reputation. They're people you can trust. Give them a call, 866-932-0635. That's 866-932-0635. Or visit them online at legacypminvestments.com. Till next hour, your influence counts, so use it.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Talk Radio 77 WABC. Now, here's Frank Morano.
Look out, ladies and gentlemen. I just poured myself my second cup of coffee for the morning. Usually, I do this show with either zero cups of coffee or maybe one, but usually it's zero. And today, I am going with two. I don't know why. I don't know why. I just kind of felt, I don't know, it smells so good. There's just something about the smell of coffee that once you get a whiff, ugh, you just want to consume it. More on that in just a bit. But saw an interesting article the other day in the New York Post, of all places, showed Larry David. Larry David is the creator of Seinfeld. He's the star of Curb Your Enthusiasm. Happens to be 74 years old. Having lunch in
California, I think, with Timothy Chalamet. Timothy Chalamet is a young man. He's 25 years old and one of the kind of the up and coming. I don't know that he's even up and coming anymore. He's an established star. He was in Homeland. He was in Call Me By Your Name. He was in a number of Oscar nominated films. He himself has been Oscar nominated. He's a very hot young actor right now. And actually, he went to LaGuardia with two of my siblings. One of them said he was pretty nice. The other one said he wasn't that nice. So whatever. But he is all the rage right now in Hollywood. 25 years old, having lunch with Larry David, who's 74 years old. And I thought that was interesting when they met. Maybe they're working on something together. Maybe Timothy Chalamet is going to be on the upcoming season of Curb Your Enthusiasm. But there was an interesting story by Dori Lewak. And it says, here's the headline. Larry David and Timothy Chalamet's age gap has nothing on these in real life bromances. And I devoured this story. I absolutely loved it. And this story that Dori wrote went into all of the, not all, some of the friendships that develop between people of different age groups. Comedian and rabbi Mike Fine, 40 years old, has developed a great friendship with Bernie Burns, who's 93 years old. You have a situation where another couple of friends is 53 years apart. 81-year-old Holocaust survivor and motivational speaker Sammy Steigman, who spent his years of his childhood in a labor camp in Ukraine and was subjected to Nazi medical experimentation, befriended Rami Matan Evan Esch, a 40-year-old Bushwick-based rapper who goes by Kosha Dills, and they have stayed friends. So they chronicle all these friendships with people who are light years apart in age. And this really struck a chord with me because I am somebody that largely doesn't see age. And throughout my whole life, really from the time that I was 14 or 15, I have tended to have friends that were much older than me. And that is generally those have been my closest friends, people that have been older. And not everybody feels this way. My wife and I, for instance, recently, I suggested, why don't we go out to dinner with so-and-so couple? She said, oh, I don't know. I don't want to go out with so-and-so. I said, well, how come? They're so much fun. They're so interesting. And my wife said to me, well, you know, I know you don't feel this way, but sometimes I enjoy spending time with people who are my own age or around my own age, not people that are 30, 40 years older than us. And I get that. And I get that there are a lot of people that feel that way. I don't. First of all, I don't really see age, but if I saw age, I would still go out of my way to have friendships with people who are significantly older than me and significantly younger than me. For some of the reasons that Manhattan psychologist Dr. Chloe Carmichael cites in this New York Post article, it's such a healthy thing, Dr. Carmichael says. It's such a healthy thing. Our society talks a lot about diversity these days, and that can include age. Different backgrounds and experiences can enrich each other in many ways, whether it's skill sets or knowledge or perspectives on life. There's so much to learn and appreciate intergenerationally. You can really learn from each other. So I would be curious, have you had a close friend,
I'm not talking about a casual acquaintance, a close friend that is significantly different in age than you. I'm not talking romance here because that's a subject for a different day. And that's an interesting subject and we could talk about that. But a purely platonic friendship with either man, woman, transgender, whatever, that is significantly different in age, 40, 50, 60 years difference, whether older or younger, and how has that worked out for you, having an intergenerational relationship? 800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. One of my great heroes in life, somebody I am so sorry that I never got to meet, and I'm even sorrier I never got to interview, was Hugh Hefner. And I love Hugh Hefner for many, many reasons. And I was, in preparing for this segment, I was struck by a profile that was written about Hugh Hefner in Esquire magazine about 8 or 9 years ago. And the writer writes, one of the defining aspects of life at the mansion, the Playboy Mansion, is that in its ignorance of time, it must also ignore age. At every party, at even the smallest gathering, there are men and women from both ends of the spectrum, virtual teenagers and ancients meeting in some happy middle. Hefner introduces Crystal to Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers movies or the lost celebrities in his scrapbooks. She introduces him to True Blood. He'll be like, boobs, I like this scene, Crystal says, or Twitter. Quote, ageism is a variation of racism or sexism, all the other isms. That's according to Hugh Hefner. In his scrapbooks, there's a remarkable in-house memo that he wrote on October 18th, 1961, when Playboy Club franchises in Miami and New Orleans refused to admit African-American key holders, and he bought the clubs back. And it goes into how you see people at these Playboy Mansion parties who are in their early 20s, who are in their early 80s, who are in their mid-30s, who are in their mid-70s. And I think that's great. 800-848-9222. I'd be curious about your experience with intergenerational friendships. Are you more like my wife? And maybe this is the case with most people, where most of your friends tend to be around the same age as you. Or, and when I say around the same age, I'll say give or take 10 years, right? Or are you more like me and presumably the people in this Tim Chalamet, Larry David article, where you do have friends that are 30, 40, 50 years older or younger than you? And what's that experience been like? 800-848-9222. In my case, I can tell you the experiences that I've had with my close friends that have been older have been everything. They have been so elemental to making my life what it is today and making me who I am today, quite frankly. There is one obvious drawback, which is it seems like I'm always at a funeral. It seems like I'm always at a wake. Last week, one of my very close friend passed away. He was only 80. He had just turned 80, and he'd passed away. It was very sad. But the same can be said for my relationship with Barry Farber. Now, Barry was an incredibly close friend. He and I would talk on the phone. He and I would exchange emails. He and I would go on each other's radio shows. He and I would exchange letters. I would support everything that he did. He would support everything that I did. He'd help me with things that I needed help with. I would help him with things that he needed help with. And we'd look out for one another. And he was an incredibly close friend. I was heartbroken when he died, even though I know, you know, he was suffering in the last year or two of his life. I was heartbroken. And it's a tough thing when a close friend dies. And it's an even tougher thing when you have so many close friends that die. And if you're someone like me who ends up having many friends that are older, that happens more frequently than it should. The best example is my friendship with Joe Franklin. Joe Franklin was a friend and a mentor and somebody that I looked up to and somebody that I admired and someone who I treasured every minute that we spent together. And he died 5 years ago. And Joe was such a close friend. And I think if he were here, he would say the same thing, only he would say it much wittier. And, you know, he'd say something along the lines of, oh, Frank, Frank, I wouldn't trade your friendship for $1,000, $2,000, maybe. But so that's the negative of being friends with people that are significantly older than you. But I've been very blessed. Barry Farber, Bob Grant, Joe Franklin, my friend Lou Ween, and a lot of other people who you've never heard of, who are not famous but happen to be a good deal older. I learned from their experiences. I have benefited from my relationships with them more than I can say, and I think they've benefited from me. Where do you stand on that, though? Do most of your friends tend to be in your age group or of a significantly different age? 800-848-9222. And whichever way that cuts, what are the key benefits and drawbacks of having a social group either in your age or significantly different from your age? 800-848-9222. Let us say hello to first-time caller.
We're sorry.
Lizzie in Northport. Hello, Lizzie.
Hi there. I just want you to know I love your program.
Thank you.
I have had a friendship with a young lady that I call my beacon of light. She lives in California. I sort of picked her up at the airport in Sacramento many years ago. Almost, I'd say 17 years ago, she was going off to college. I was coming back to New York. I was feeling sad, having left my grandchildren and daughter after a visit, and she was going off to college, her first year of college. And I wrote her a little note on the plane, and she gave me her address. And we started meeting, and our meeting point was the Cloisters. She would come from Manhattan College, and I would come from Northport. And we had that friendship for 4 years. My partner and I went to her graduation at the college, and all these years we've remained in touch. Whenever I go to California, I would see her. She came here. And just recently, we had 2 days in the city on her way to see some of her college friends. And I am pushing 80.
That's great.
She is now 35.
So you guys have been friends for almost 20 years then?
Yes.
That's great. That's great. Now, Lizzie, some people may be I think that's wonderful, and I appreciate you sharing that story. Some people may be surprised that you can develop such a close friendship with someone who you don't share any of the same pop cultural references with. How does that work? When you guys get together, what do you do? What do you talk about? What kind of things do you do together?
When we got together in those college years, we always went for walks in Fort Tryon Park. We'd go for lunch. We'd go for dessert. Her mom is German. I'm from the Netherlands. And so we loved good bread, good cheese, and chocolate. We had that in common. She claims that I made her a better person, that she learned so much from me. And to tell you the truth, I learned a lot from her.
Well, that's wonderful. That's how every relationship should be. And I appreciate you sharing that, Lizzie. And it sounds like your friend is lucky to have you in her life. And that is exactly what Lizzie just described. Those are the key benefits of an intergenerational friendship. And I would urge you, and again, if you want to comment on your experiences with intergenerational friendships, give me a call, 1-800-848-9222. That's 1-800-848-WABC. If you are somebody who tends to mostly have friendships in your own age group, and you know, I don't want to make it sound like my wife only deals with people in her own age group. Because of her marriage to me, she finds herself interacting socially with people in every age group. So I think being married to me has, in that respect, expanded her horizons a little bit, just as being married to her has expanded mine in all sorts of other areas. But if you're someone that tends to have friends pretty much within your own age group, I really would encourage you, as difficult as it might be if you're a younger person, I would really encourage you to try to cultivate a relationship with somebody who's significantly different in age, be it older or younger. If you're 40 years old, try and find a 17-year-old to be friends with, or an 80-year-old. If you're 50 years old, try and find a 20-year-old to be friends with, or a 90-year-old. If you're 90 years old, try and find a 30-year-old to be friends with. I think the value that will serve both of you is going to be extraordinary. 800-848-9222. Two of the people chronicled in that New York Post article, they talk a little bit about this. One of the comedians, the 40-year-old, Mr. Fine, Burns' long comedy career was a fodder for a lot of their discussions. Quote, I can't have a conversation with a young person about Jack Benny because they don't know who he is. They can't name any of the Marx brothers, let alone Groucho. The only Marx they know is Karl Marx, lamented Fine, who added that despite being 53 years apart, they have the same priorities. That is exactly what I'm talking about. 800-848-WABC. I would love to hear your experiences on this. John Vito in Staten Island has been patiently holding. Hello, John Vito.
Hey, Frank, how are you? Good day to you. And I understand, first things first, you're a father now.
Well, not yet, but hopefully soon.
I said, well, I don't know. I don't listen to you every night because, you know, whatever. But anyway, all right, when is about? When is it going to be about the baby?
December 6th.
Oh, December, we got time. Maybe I meet you. I thought I was going to run into you for the memorial. I was at Snag Harbor because, you know, my boy's offices with the fire department. But anyway, and then I went to see the monument that you mentioned on the radio. You see the profile, the name, the occupation they had.
Right. Isn't that breathtaking?
Yo, man, that's unbelievable. I was thinking, you know, I said, I got to go. Maybe I'll see Franco, but I couldn't stay for the ceremony because I went to Atlantic City. I had to use my stupid timeshare. But anyway, I'm angry since the other subject because I remember growing up, you know, when I was in Bari, we didn't want to wait 2 hours for the train. We had 8 to 4, 4 days a week at 2 days, 8 to 12. So that the train, we had to wait 2 hours to go to my town. So we used to get to the corner, and we used to call the auto stop. That's what we used to call it. And we used to hitchhike. And I tell you the truth, I would want any of my kids or my grandkids do that, even at those days. But those days, I don't know, we did it. Maybe we ignored anything else. At times, it was scary, though, because you just put yourself in the car. Yeah, the guy opened it. You have no seat belts, but the guy would drive. And at the time, you know, it was like 120 kilometers. It was a lot for me. And you think, God, this stranger, and he's driving. Who knows what the hell he's going to do? And if he's going to drop you off, you worry about it. I remember that. I was 15. 16.
Oh, sure. Well, no, I can understand that. I mean, these days, thankfully, there's a lot more safety features in the car. So at the very least, you won't have to worry about a lack of.
But Frank, you won't want nobody that you know. These days, this is the world the way it's going. Forget about it. It's really. I mean,
well, look, that seems to be the consensus, John Vito.
Well, you got no laws. You got no laws right now. What do you expect? And all these people.
Yeah, I don't think statistically that's true, and I appreciate the call. Again, not to go back to the discussion from last hour, but if you look at the era that everybody was talking about that they were comfortable hitchhiking in, the 60s, the 70s, the early 80s, there was more random crime then than there is now. You want to talk about what New York was like 30 years ago? 2,300 murders a year. New York, even with the uptick in crime, we're nowhere near that, thankfully. All right, we're going to do the $1,000 minute in just a few minutes. The way this works is you have to answer 10 questions within a minute. As soon as you answer a question incorrectly, the contest is over. So if you think you've got what it takes, you can be the seventh caller to 1-800-848-9222. 10 trivia questions in 60 seconds. That's the rule. The trivia questions are not that tough. But if you want to participate, give us a call, 800-848-9222, and be the seventh caller. And if you are, then you can play the game if you've never played it before. But you can be a winner regardless if you try Life Change Tea. This is a great product that I drink every day, and I'm a big fan of. It's a powerful herbal proprietary blend. It's a cold tea that is made without caffeine, no fillers, no preservatives. It's completely organic, but it does a whole lot more than just give you energy. It detoxifies you. It cleanses you from the inside out. That's why their slogan is the tea that makes you go. You can check out the testimonials for yourself at getthetea.com. You can also order some of the tea on there, and you can order a number of other supplements on there, supplements that are great for energy, supplements that are great for the immune system, supplements that are great for a wide variety of any aspects of your health that you are looking to improve. GetTheTea.com. That's GetTheTea.com. And if you order anything on there, any of the supplements or the tea itself, and you use the promo code Frank, you'll get to enjoy free shipping anywhere in these United States. That's GetTheTea.com, promo code Frank.
You're hearing things
on 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano, and we are getting ready to try and give away $1,000 as part of our nightly journey doing
The Other Side of Midnight presents...
It's the $1,000 Minute. Answer 10 questions correctly in 1 minute, and you could win $1,000. Here's your host, Frank Morano.
Yes, thank you, Chris Libertini. The rules are fairly simple.
10 questions. If you answer them correctly in 60 seconds, you win $1,000. No tricks, no gimmicks. That's as simple as that. As soon as you answer a question incorrectly or as soon as your time runs out, that's it. The contest is over. You lose. But if you're lucky, maybe we'll still give you a hat. Let's meet today's contestant, Peter in Piscataway. It's that away. Hello, Peter.
How are we doing tonight?
We're doing well. We're doing well. So you're clear on the rules of the contest, right, Peter?
Yes. Try to get 10 questions in a minute.
Boom. What are you going to spend the $1,000 on if you win it?
A brake job.
There you go. Man after my own heart. Always got car trouble. All right, Matt, Peter, if you're ready, we'll get started, okay?
I'm ready.
All right, let's do it, Matt. Which country was Adolf Hitler the leader of?
Germany.
Name one radio partner that Curtis Sliwa has had.
Lon Kobe.
Who is the speaker, the current speaker of the New York State Assembly?
It's always that one, right? That one I don't know.
Well done, Peter. Made it to the third question. It is Carl Hastie. Carl Hastie is the Speaker of the State Assembly. Thank you for playing. Peter, hang on. Give Molly your information, and we are going to put you in our queue to get a complimentary The Other Side of Midnight baseball cap. And if you want to try and purchase a WABC cap of any sort, you can go to WABCRadioStore.com. We are going to be adding new The Other Side of Midnight merchandise soon. If you want to order the hat for this program, you have to go at the top, WABCRadioStore.com. That's WABCRadioStore.com. Ton of great stuff on there. But you go to personalities and then you go to Frank Morano, and you have to access it that way. But rumor has it they're going to be adding a T-shirt soon and some other things. But apparently there's been a big demand for hats for this show. So that's great. But you can still buy hats on other shows. By the way, Sunday is the big day. I am looking forward to seeing many of you at the Stephen Siller Tunnel to Tower Foundation Walk and Run. That's going to start in Brooklyn. We're going to run or walk through the Brooklyn Battery Tunnel. And it should be a great event. If you want to participate or if you want to make a small donation to my efforts or to the efforts of any of the other hosts, Juliet Huddy, Dominic Carter, Bernie and Sid, Greg Kelly, just go to WABCRadio.com/walk. That's WABCRadio.com/walk. I'm looking forward to seeing many of you. I think what I'm going to do, I was telling Juliet this yesterday, I think what I'm going to do, my initial plan was to walk. But I think what I'm going to do is sort of walk a little, run a little, and then walk a little. I'm going to alternate. Not only because you maybe tend to burn a little more calories running, but my wife's baby shower is that day, that afternoon. So if I walk, forget about it. It'll take me 2 hours to be done with this run and walk. But if I run a little bit and walk a little bit, maybe I'll be done at a quicker pace and I can get back to my neighborhood. And while my wife is hosting all these ladies at the baby shower, I can entertain their husbands and boyfriends and fathers and brothers at a nearby establishment. So I can do kind of a counter bridal or baby shower, right? So a broby shower. So that'll be Sunday. So that's why I think I'm going to walk and run. But we definitely could use your help in terms of raising some money. It's a great cause. They do a lot of really wonderful work in terms of providing homes, mortgage-free homes for people who die in the line of duty. And it is a charity that I'm really proud to be associated with. So if you want to participate and raise some money, WABCRadio.com/walk. If you want to find me on Twitter, Facebook, social media, or social media of any sort, or just send me an email, go to the website MoranoVision.com. That's MoranoVision.com. You can also find the
podcast through there. If you're not subscribing to the podcast, I do hope you will, because a lot of people don't get to listen to the whole show. And if you want to subscribe to the podcast, then just go to WABCradio.com and you can find it up there, or just go to MoranoVision.com. That's sort of your gateway to all things Frank Morano. So, all right. Now, I wanted to ask you a question. I can't remember where I saw this the other day, and I just tried to find it, and I couldn't find the article. It might have been a tweet. It might have been something that I saw elsewhere. But who is the most recognizable person in Disney? By far, and it's been the case for the last 92 years, the most recognizable Disney character has definitely been this guy.
Oh boy. Wow, what a beauty.
Mickey Mouse. That, of course, is from Mickey and the Seal. Now, Mickey Mouse has been in a lot of films. He's been in shorts. He's been in features. He's had cameos in a lot of films. But a question I came across the other day, and for the life of me, I can't remember where I came across it. This is the problem with devouring as much information as I do and trying to put it aside somewhere. Mickey Mouse really hasn't starred in a film in decades. Decades. And in terms of appearances that he's made, Mickey Mouse made his big screen debut in the 1928 short film Steamboat Willie, but his last appearance in a Disney short was the Oscar-nominated 1995 film Runaway Brain. Now, Mickey has not had a big role in a lot of Disney films. So you ask yourself, what's going on? And again, I don't mean to be conspiratorial, but what is going on at Disney in that they have essentially warehoused their most recognizable character? Is this a function of somehow Mickey falling out of favor with the politically correct times? Is Mickey not woke enough for this generation of children and filmgoers? Is it a function of the fact that Mickey has, I don't know, he's gotten stale, hasn't refreshed his act at all? Or is it something else here? Because to me, I find it very suspicious that Disney, the corporate executives at Disney, and we used to be owned by Disney in the interest of full disclosure, no longer are. The corporate executives at Disney that make these decisions, the creative executives, they have chosen to essentially limit their most recognizable character to being a brand ambassador. He's not in any films anymore. Maybe some direct-to-video stuff. You don't see him playing a prominent role in the company these days, at least in terms of the creative output of the company. Disney's making a lot of films, short films, long films. And yet, they don't seem to be including this guy.
Yeah, big clown. Now look what you've done.
And
scram!
Why is that the case? Where, oh, where has Mickey Mouse gone? 800-848-WABC. That's 1-800-848-9222. I find it very, very suspicious.
I do remember seeing in the theater about 8 years ago, they did make a new Mickey Mouse short. It was called Get a Horse, and it was basically an homage to the old-timey Mickey Mouse shorts of the 20s and 30s.
Now, that short, Get a Horse, Was that new Mickey Mouse footage, or was it archival footage from old films?
Brand spanking new. It was a hybrid of the old animation of the 20s and 30s mixed with computer animation.
Interesting. Okay.
They also brought back, I remember, an old Disney character. It's kind of the precursor of Mickey Mouse, made a cameo, Oswald the Lucky Rabbit.
Interesting. Interesting. Mm-hmm. All right. Well,
I've got a suggestion for him.
Yeah?
He should put a shirt on.
Mickey.
Yeah.
Well,
dude's walking around without a shirt on. It's a little Chippendales, you know?
When you see Mickey in the theme parks, he does wear a shirt. I mean, sometimes he's actually very formal. He wears almost a suit, kind of. So I get where you're coming from, Molly. Look, in the 20s, in the 30s, it was a different era. Now, what Matt says is correct. I just did a little quick homework. Get a Horse came out about 8 years ago. And it was an animated comedy short film combining black and white hand-drawn animation and color computer animation. And it featured a lot of the characters of the 1920s Mickey Mouse cartoons. But that short, which is 8 years old now, was the first original Mickey Mouse theatrical animated short since Runaway Brain in 1995. So it had been almost 20 years since Mickey, their most recognizable character, had been theatrically released. I mean, you compare that to what we see from other children's characters, I don't think there's any comparison. If you look at what companies like Marvel do with their recognizable characters, or DC Comics, or Pixar. Pixar is not as good of an example because that's such a more modern company. But a character that has had almost a century of being the face of Disney, seems to me they've put him on the shelf. 800-848-WABC, your thoughts. Let me say hello to E. Frank in Astoria. Hello, E. Frank.
Yes, hello, Frank. Good morning. You know what I think happened to Mickey Mouse? I think he lost popularity against the sign of the times, which is he lost popularity against aggressive hip-hop artists, commercialized media, and other forms of computerized commercialization, that Mickey Mouse is no longer a popular children's fanatical way of seeing life anymore in this time and era that we live in. And maybe you might not agree with me, Frank, but, you know, he's been replaced by many new idols, such as 50 Cent other...
E. Frank, it gives me a lot of pleasure to say I don't agree with you. Now, you say Mickey Mouse has been replaced with people like 50 Cent. That is not true, because 50 Cent is a real person. He's a hip-hop artist. He's not a character in a Disney film. It's not as if Disney is putting out films starring 50 Cent. I mean, that's ridiculous. I mean, they're putting out, again, who are the – Frozen was a Disney film, right? So they're putting out films with Olaf, right, and not films with – Mickey Mouse.
Yeah, it would have made more sense to say, like, Mickey Mouse got replaced by Buzz Lightyear and Woody.
Well, yeah, yes, right. That would be better. But if you look at what Disney's doing, I know people may say, well, why would they recycle an old character? They do it all the time. You know what the big Disney film out now on Disney Plus is? And in fact, I think my wife wants to see it, and I'll probably end up watching it with her, is Cruella. Cruella. That's Cruella de Vil.
A great
that is,
movie.
It is good. It is good.
I've seen it, yeah.
So that is a character that's 50, 60 years old. But Mulan, that's a character that has already seen its day. So it's not as if they're only putting out new characters. They are recycling a fair amount of characters. Mickey Mouse just happens to not be one of them. They did a new Lion King. They did a new Aladdin. They did, I think, two new Mary Poppins films. But Mickey gets kind of sidelined. Curious why you think that's the case. 800-848-9222. Let me say hello to Anthony on Long Island. Hello, Anthony.
How you doing?
I'm doing all right. Thanks.
When your baby's born, you'll see Mickey Mouse.
Where will I see him?
Disney Channel. Mickey Mouse Clubhouse. All of the little kids love it. And, you know, it's a cartoon.
Well, right.
My DVR was full of it when my kids were little.
All the more reason that I am, and I have no doubt that you're correct, all the more reason that I'm perplexed as to why they're not releasing theatrical films, either shorts or features, starring Mickey. So he's a popular character with kids. He's a synonymous with the Disney brand. He's one of the most recognizable icons in the world. And yet Disney, one of the largest film producers in the world, is not putting him in any new features. And at least they've only put him in two shorts over the course of the last 20 years. So I think that that kind of enhances my curiosity. Although, I'll be honest with you, I don't know what my kid is going to be into, but I was not really much of a Mickey Mouse person when I was a child. I watched kind of a lot of the same stuff that I watch now. I did like I like Star Trek. I liked Star Trek when I was a kid, and I'm hoping my child will gravitate towards the same thing. And I like professional wrestling. 800-848-9222. I was never into Disney films, honestly. My mom would take me to a couple of these Disney films. I didn't like them even as a kid. I found them cheesy even as a kid. Maybe it's different for girls. I don't know. But I was never into it. 800-848-WABC. Peter's in East Stroudsburg. Hello, Peter.
Hey, how you doing, Brad?
Good.
Yeah, I have a theory. I think Mickey, I worked for Disney for 37 years. I think Mickey became very demanding in his contract demands. You know, I think the stardom went to his head. He became a big problem for Bob Iger. And, you know, I think they wanted to teach him a lesson. Also, I think the cancel culture came up with some remarks that Mickey made, you know, like 78 years ago.
Interesting. I was wondering if that was the case. Did Mickey have some old tweets or some old radio interviews in which he called African Americans black people, and that all of a sudden got him canceled, like one of the crows in the movie Dumbo? Very interesting, Peter. And I wondered if that was the case. And as a former Disney cast member yourself, I appreciate you kind of shedding some light on that one. Curious if you agree with Peter on that one. Rosemary's in the Hudson Valley. Hello, Rosemary.
He stole a little bit of my thunder. I was going to say something like that. I think there's several reasons. They wait for the kids to go to Disneyland and or Disney World. I think the merchandise around the world pays for everything. And the last thing I think is he might have turned he wants to be referred to as binary, and he no longer is interested in Minnie. And they Disney didn't know how to handle that.
Interesting, because the other theory that I have, Rosemary, and it's interesting that you mentioned the relationship with Minnie. The other theory that I have is, you know, Mickey and Minnie, as far as we know, at least as far as I know, and I don't pretend to be an expert in the history of Mickey Mouse. Mickey and Minnie Mouse have never been married, right? But they share a last name, right? They're both Mickey Mouse, Minnie Mouse. Why do they share a last name? Could they have been, and this is a callback to our discussion yesterday, could they, in spite of the fact that they've been romantically involved for 70 years or so, could they be cousins or something? Is that what Disney is trying to keep under wraps? Because there's something going on here. There is a reason that they are keeping the mouse away from the multiplex. 800-848-9222. Juliet Huddy is here. What do you think about all this, Juliet?
They're mice. That's why their last name is Mouse. That's why they have a similar last name, because they both are mice.
Well,
it wouldn't be Mickey Alligator, Minnie Monkey. It's Mouse.
Well, I feel like that's an overly simplistic explanation. For instance, Goofy and Pluto are both dogs, but we don't call them Pluto dog and Goofy dog.
Because we don't call them by their last name. Pluto the dog, Goofy the dog.
Well, that's a description. We don't call
Oscar
Mickey,
the Grouch.
Mickey the Mouse.
What is
and
Oscar?
Minnie the Mouse.
What is Oscar, by the way?
Right, he's a Grouch.
Right. Well, we don't know any of his friends, so you can't say that they're not called Stuart the Grouch.
Well,
Mike the Grouch.
Maybe he doesn't have many friends because he's so grouchy.
Well, funny enough, a lot of grouchy people have friends. But the headline from this whole story, the takeaway, Frank, is that it doesn't surprise me, Molly, nor does it surprise Matt, that you didn't like Disney films when you were a child. I'm just saying, you were an old man by the time you popped out of the womb. You were hatched, and all of a sudden, you're an old man.
Yeah, that's true. I was actually like Benjamin Button. I was born as an 85-year-old. I'm like Merlin. I just keep youthening.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well, thank you. Juliet Huddy is here. If you support her thesis, you can give some money to her contribution in Sunday's walk. Are you coming in Monday for your birthday? Are we going to do something fun Monday for your birthday? Or are you going to like do your stay home thing and party with your husband and stuff?
Probably stay home and party with my husband.
Well, so
he just got me mid protein bar bite.
Sorry. All right. Well, sorry. Enjoy it.
It's like chewy, so it's hard to talk.
Fair enough.
I can talk to you. It's going to sound like I have food in my mouth.
No. Well, enjoy the protein bar. I'm going to hear from Ed the Milkman. Ed, give me your theory on this.
I have two things. Number one is I think like Harry Potter and these other things interested kids more, because that's their style today. And also, I had read an article where the Chinese finance a lot of these films and things in Hollywood, and they don't like the stereotype that these cartoons would give Chinese people or a Chinese person that is, they're not the winner at the end. They want movies where the Chinese guy's the hero.
You know what, Ed, in all seriousness, and thank you for the call, I think you're absolutely right. Disney has become increasingly dependent on China as a foreign market for its films. And I suspect that the Chinese government does not want Mickey Mouse playing a prominent role in these films. I don't know if it's because they have the year of the rat and not the year of the mouse. I don't know if because this is part of Xi Jinping's crackdown on effeminate men in media and he's got the high-pitched voice and that doesn't fit the masculine archetype that Xi Jinping wants Chinese children to have. I absolutely, and this is not shtick, this is not a joke, I absolutely think whatever the reason is for Mickey Mouse's disappearance from the cinema, China, and appeasing the Chinese government and Chinese audiences is somehow behind it. I really believe that. And they're so desperate to conquer the Chinese marketplace that they'll do anything. And for some reason, I don't know if this is part of the deal with Shanghai Disney, for some reason, they're keeping Mickey under wraps. And I suspect it has something to do with China. All right. Well, I'll tell you, you're not going to find any mice at Trinity Rehab. These are great folks. These are responsible folks. These are people that will restore your freedom to live your life pain-free. They are not your father's physical therapy. They have something called the EPAP machine, which is cutting edge and state of the art. It's FDA approved non-surgical acoustic pressure wave technology. It's similar to what's used to break up kidney stones. It breaks up scar tissue and enhances healing, gets rid of pain fast. It's effective for conditions like back pain, neck pain, tennis elbow, shoulder tendonitis. No prescription needed to get started. In just 3 5-minute sessions, you'll be virtually pain-free. No prescription needed to get started. In fact, using this treatment from Trinity Rehab could keep you from getting surgery or becoming dependent on prescription pain medication. So if you have back pain, neck pain, knee pain, shoulder tendonitis, any sort of chronic pain, call Trinity Rehab. 800-518-0977. That's 800-518-0977. Or go to trinity-rehab.com.
You're hearing things
on 77.
WABC.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano, 77 WABC.
All right, is everybody ready?
Yes!
Yeah! Yeah! All right, now here we go. A one, a two, a one, two, three.
Mickey's Monkey Miracles. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Time for you to be heard for 15 seconds. 1-800-848-9222. We're going to go quickly here because it's still time for
The Other Side of Midnight. This is 15 Seconds of Fame.
Joe in Manhattan, hello.
Curtis Sliwa, next mayor. If 83% Asians vote for him, blacks 10%, Hispanics 67%, Jews 58%, and non-Hispanic whites 50%, Curtis will win.
Russ in White Plains.
Why did Manhattan Borough President Gail Brewer metaphorically lynch three proud black women on a scaffold of vaccine mandates at Carmine's restaurant? She foolishly held a press conference which brought down the wrath of Black Lives Matter on the neighborhood and undesirable attention to Carmine's name.
Finally, Neil on Staten Island.
M-I-C-K-E-Y-M-O-U-S-E.
You got to end it there. Thank you, Neil. That slams the lid on things for this morning. Stay tuned to the WABC Early News with Juliet Huddy and me. But first, 77 seconds of news with Deb Valentine to be continued.